I call the meeting to order. Please, everybody, find a seat. My name is Myron Fox, and it's my honor to be your moderator for the 2009 annual town meeting. I've appointed longtime resident Fred Pryor to be the assistant town moderator. In case this hall gets filled up, he will be presiding in the cafeteria. Fred is the president of the Board of Trustees of the Wayside Inn. I now declare a quorum present. Please turn your attention to the view graph, and we will soon show our appreciation for the sacrifice of the men and women in our armed services. The names of those with Sudbury connections will be on the view, are now on the view graph as compiled by Brian Stearns, Sudbury's veteran agent. Let us remember the words of then-Captain, now-Major Dennis Ford, a Sudbury resident and a veteran of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, who addressed our town meeting just 2 years ago. Quote, "There are still many places in the world that you cannot debate openly and participate in the democratic process. Although we as a society may not all agree on every issue, we do have the freedom to debate openly and participate in democracy. My fellow Sudbury residents, you are the legislative body that will help shape the future here in Sudbury. Let me remind you to be civil in your debates and fair-minded in your votes, as well as cherish the tradition of freedom we all share here in the United States." End quote. As you know, each year we have the Pledge of Allegiance led at the annual town meeting by an LS student. This year, the individual selected for this honor is Patrick Hebel. Patrick, please come forward. A few words about Pat. He comes to us as the DAR award winner for 2009, an all-around recommendation from the LS teaching staff. The DAR award is voted on by faculty and staff for the student who best exemplifies outstanding qualities of service, leadership, dependability, and patriotism in their school, home, and community. Pat is a gifted musician, a dedicated athlete, and a morally guided human being. His active and inquisitive mind is an asset in the most challenging courses LS has to offer, and he has deliberately pursued courses that are both demanding in nature and invigorating. Pat is also a peer leader, and he is also a weekly mentor at Curtis Middle School. Please recognize and welcome Pat Hebel, who will lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. Could you now all rise, please? The flag is to my right.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Pat. The certified free cash, according to town accountant Barbara Chisholm, is now $15,235. I have examined and found in order the call of the meeting, the office's return of service, confirmation of delivery of the warrant to residents by Boy Scouts Troop 61, to whom we owe a debt of gratitude. I recognize Selectman Chairman Lawrence O'Brien for a motion to dispense with the reading of the call of the annual meeting, the office's return of service, notice, and the individual articles of the warrant.
So moved, Mr. Moderator.
Does that have a second? It does. All in favor, please signify by raising your cards. Thank you. Those opposed? It is a unanimous vote, and it passes. I would now like to introduce, as we do every year, our town officials, particularly for those folks who haven't been to town meeting before. So with each official, when I mention his or her name, please raise your hand when your name is called. And if you are facing me, could you turn or stand up, turn around, and face the voters? To my right is our town clerk, Rosemary Harvell. And our assistant town clerk, who had to run back to the town clerk's office to get some paperwork, Judy Newton, will be to her right. To my left is John Drabinski, Bill Keller, and Chair Lawrence O'Brien. Town manager is Maureen Valente. Town accountant down here is Barbara Chisholm. Thank you, Barbara. Director of Assessing, Maureen Hafner. Town council to my immediate left, Paul Kenny. At the view graph, we have Mary McCormick, the administrative assistant to the Board of Selectmen. Patty Golden, supervisor of the Office of Selectmen. Elaine Jones, who manages the town legal department. Mark Thompson, our technology administrator. Finance committee, to my far left, Bob Jacobson, Jamie Gossels, Sheila Stewart, Jim Rao, Bill Nealon, Jr., Marty Raganese, Debbie Zerka, Taj Gozdak, who is away right now, and Chuck Woodard, the chair of the Finance Committee. I'd also like to introduce our assistant town manager, Wayne Walker, and our treasurer, collector, and finance director, Andrea Turkelson. And I see our DPW director, Bill Place, and our fire chief right here in front. And where's our police chief? Right there. Did I miss anybody? We're going to get to you. Coffee and snacks are in the area where you checked in tonight. It's sponsored by Noise PTO, which works with principals and teachers to provide programming to Noise students to enhance their educational experience. LS informs me that there can be no food or drink in the auditorium except for water, but you may consume food and drink outside the auditorium or in the cafeteria. I have several announcements to make very quickly. In the back of your warrant, the very last page, there are several opportunities to sign up for. Volunteers are needed for the annual roadside cleanup, which will be held on Saturday, April 25. Trash bags will be handed out behind Town Hall from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Also, you'll see in the back of your warrant that you may register your interest in serving on a town board or committee. Please consider how you might lend your talents to town government. Some committee memberships do not require a great deal of time, but all provide valuable contributions. The fire chief has reminded me to remind you that there are two exits at the rear of the floor of the auditorium and also in the balcony, and that in addition there are two exits right here off the stage, stairways going up to the stage, and you can exit behind the curtain. And bathrooms are located across the hall from the auditorium floor, and there's also bathrooms across the hall in the cafeteria. The Earth Decade Committee has requested that I mention to you the following. In the interest of promoting use of alternative energy, we ask Sudbury citizens to consider joining the NSTAR Green Program. By joining, every NSTAR customer can request that 50 to 100% of the power received can be generated by New York Wind Farm for a small monthly upcharge. There are materials on the tables where you entered the building about various warrant articles, and there are also extra warrants there if you forgot to bring the one that was delivered to your home by the Boy Scouts. And we also have several warrants right here in front of me. So please come forward and grab one if you need it. Also, I don't know if they're present, but our state senators are Jamie Eldridge and Susan Fargo, and our state representative is Tom Conroy, right over there. I'd also like to introduce Jim Lafferty to my right. Jim, if you can come forward. Jim is the principal of Minuteman Regional Vocational Tech School District, and also with him is Dave Manjares, who's a Sudbury resident, and he has diligently served as our representative to that school committee. I recognize Selectman Bill Keller for a resolution in memory of those citizens who have served the town and passed away during this past year.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Whereas the town of Sudbury has enjoyed the blessing of those in the community who gave their time and talent to enrich the quality of life in our town, and whereas this past year has seen several of its citizens and employees who have rendered public service and civic duty pass from among us, now, therefore, be it resolved that the town of Sudbury extend its heartfelt sympathy to the families of those persons and recognize their service and dedication to the community. Elizabeth Campbell, born 1945, moved to Sudbury in 1976. She served as a special education teaching assistant at the high school from 1987 to 1993. Iris DeLuca, born in 1928, moved to Sudbury in 1968. She was an election worker from 2001 to 2008. Rita Eisner, born in 1916 in Sudbury, worked at the high school here as a cafeteria worker from 1978 to 1981. Joan S. Fellman, born in 1932, moved to Sudbury in 1959 and served as a school guidance counselor and teacher from 1970 to 1988. Laverne S. Ferris, born in 1910 in Sudbury, was a Horse Pond Road and Nixon school teacher from 1959 to 1974. Charles Addison Frost, born in 1929, moved to Sudbury in 1953. He was a police officer from 1958 to 1960 and the sealer of weights and measures from 61 to 62. John Patrick Hanley, born in 1953, was a firefighter here in Sudbury from 1978 to 1981 and then again from 1983 to 2008. Marion J. Patty Johnson, born in 1922, moved to Sudbury in 1948 and worked as a school cafeteria worker. Marguerite Keith, born in 1939, moved to Sudbury in 1969 and worked as an election worker from 1991 to 2007. Arnold A. Kramer, born in 1930, moved to Sudbury in 1975 and was a pay-per-throw committee member from 1998 to 2005. Virginia Ann Manka, born in 1933, moved to Sudbury in 1951 and was a secretary here at the high school from 1964 to 1971. Thomas W. H. Phelps. Tom Phelps was born in 1943, moved to Sudbury in 1974. He served on the planning board from 83 to 87, the Route 20 Task Force from 87 to 88, the Board of Appeals, Earth Removal Board, 87 to 92, Earth Removal Board Alternate, 96 to 2005, Board of Appeals Associate, 92 to 2005, Traffic Management Committee, 90 to 99, Fair Housing Committee, 89 to 2006, Town Reorganization Blue Ribbon Committee, 1994, Strategic Planning Committee, 2001, Economic Development Committee, 2005. As many of you, I also knew Tom personally and well, and sad to see him go, and I'm sure we're all going to miss stopping by his house in Concord Road during the annual parades, both on Memorial Day and July 4th. Betty Jean Seguin, born in 1941, moved to Sudbury in 1990. She was a cafeteria worker in 1981 to 2007. Bernice N. Smolsky, born in 1938, moved to Sudbury in 1959 and was a building department secretary from 81 to 97. Marty Spence, born in 1944, was in Sudbury and was a high school special education teaching assistant from 2005 to 2008. And Marjorie Walker, born in Sudbury in 1913, was an election worker from 1990 to 2001. Be it further resolved that the town of Sudbury and town meeting assembled record for posterity in the minutes of this meeting its recognition and appreciation for their contributions to our community.
Thank you. For many years, it has been a tradition at our annual town meeting to honor one of our citizens who has performed valuable service for the town by asking him or her to make the motion under Article 1 of the warrant. This year, it's my privilege to honor Ed Thompson. Ed is quietly unassuming, but a dedicated, consummate professional. Let me read to you some of Ed's Sudbury accomplishments. For 22 years, he was the Industrial Accident Board agent. For 17 years, he was the Massachusetts Municipal Association legislative liaison. For 5 years, he was the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority committee member. In 1982 and 88, 89, and 90, he was the acting town accountant. Most importantly, he was our executive secretary from 1972 to 1994. Before our town manager form of government, he was the CEO of Sudbury. After 1994, he was the interim town manager and led the town in its transition to the town manager form of government. For 8 years, he was also the CEO of the Lincoln Sudbury Employees Credit Union. And for the last 11 years, he is and has been and is the Sudbury Water District Treasurer. Ed is one of the most honorable public servants that I have ever worked with. It is my honor to recognize Ed for the motion under Article 1 of this year's annual town meeting.
Thank you. You have to bear with me because I don't see that well anymore. Article 1 here, reports. Move to accept the reports of the town boards, commissions, officers, and committees as printed in the 2008 town report or as otherwise presented, subject to the correction of errors if any were found.
Does that receive a second? It does. Does the FinCom have a position? It does not. The selectmen, in favor?
Yes.
Anyone, I assume no one wishes to be heard. All those in favor of Article 1 signify by raising your cards. All those opposed. It passes unanimously. Thank you very much, Ed. If you all be kind enough to turn to pages Roman numeral 3 and Roman numeral 4 in your warrant, we're now going to deal with the consent calendar. I will call out the numbers of the articles one by one. If any voter has doubt about passing any motions or wishes an explanation of any subject on the consent calendar, the voter should stand and say the word hold in a loud, clear voice when the number is called. I will then inquire as to whether the request to hold is for a question or for debate. If the purpose of the request was merely to ask a question, an attempt to obtain a satisfactory answer will be made. And if that occurs, the article will remain on the consent calendar absent a further request to hold. If the purpose of the request was to hold the article for debate, the article will be immediately removed from the consent calendar and restored to its original position in the warrant to be brought up and debated and voted on in the usual way. No voter should hesitate to exercise the right to remove matters from the consent calendar. It is the view of the voters as to the need for debate that is supreme, not that of town officials who put together the consent calendar. Having said that, it is hoped that voters will remove articles from the consent calendar only in cases of genuine concern. In past years, it has occasionally happened that articles were removed from the consent calendar for debate and, when reached in the normal course, passed unanimously without debate, thus indicating that the initial removal request was perhaps not fully considered before being exercised. Again, I will read the consent calendar article by article. If you wish anything held, please stand, say hold, and I will recognize you. Article 10. Article 11. Article 12. Article 14. Article 15. Article 18. Can you stand, please? For debate. That's 18 is off the consent calendar. 28. 29. Could you stand, please? What is your question? Could you name and address for the record, please? Thank you, Mr. Coe. I'm going to ask Jody Cadillac, the town planner, to give us the answer.
Mr. Coe is absolutely right. Buy down is not a really defined term, but the way that we use it is to define the difference between the price of a market rate unit and the price of an affordable unit. And the town's subsidies through CPA funds have bought down that price between, say, a $350,000 home to buy it at the $170,000 affordable rate. So it's a buy down. But just to clarify, that article actually will be indefinitely postponed as well.
Very good. Hang up, Mr. Coe, we're just on 29. Are you all set with 29? Can that stay on the consent calendar? Thank you very much. So we're now moving on to number 30. Was your question on 29? Please stand and give your name and address.
Martha Coe, 14 Churchill Street. I thought they just said it was going to be indefinitely postponed. If we leave it on the consent calendar, it will be passed, right?
No. You'll see language in the consent calendar that says all the other articles except for this article, which will be indefinitely postponed.
Oh, okay.
You will see it on the motion. Thank you. Is that 29? Anybody? Everyone all set with 29? Article 30. Article 32. Okay. Could one of you stand, please?
Hold for debate.
Thank you. So 32, 18, and 32 are off the consent calendar. Mark, can you do you have the capability of crossing out 18 and 32 there?
Yeah.
Great. While he's doing that, Selectman Drabinski, is there a motion to take Articles 10, 11, 12, 14, 15, 28, 29, and 30 out of order and consider them together at this time?
Yes, there is, Mr. Moderator. So move.
Is there a second? There is. Finance Committee?
No position.
Selectman?
Selectman support, Mr. Moderator.
Thank you. Anybody wish to be heard on the motion in front of you? It requires a 4/5 vote. If it's close, we'll count. Seeing no one wishing to be heard, I'll ask all those who are in favor of the motion on the view graph to raise your cards. All those opposed, the vote is unanimous. Selectman Drabinski, is there a motion in the words of the consent calendar motions as printed on page Roman numeral 4? If you can add those words to the motion, as printed on page Roman numeral 4 of the warrant for articles 10, 11, 12, 14, 15, 28, 29, and 30, except the motion under Article 29 shall be moved to indefinitely postpone.
Move in the words of moderator.
Does it receive a second? It does. Finance Committee has no position, I assume, and the selectmen are in favor. Does anybody wish to be heard on that motion? Yes, Ms. Coe.
Martha Coe, 14 Churchill Street. Somewhere I got the idea that 30 was going to be indefinitely postponed.
Hang on. No, it is not being indefinitely postponed.
Okay. Well, I thought we were.
Nope.
Thanks.
Okay. Anybody else wish to be heard on the motion before you on the view graph? Before we voted, this requires a unanimous vote. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by raising your cards. Thank you. All those opposed? It is unanimous. Both this vote and the vote before were unanimously passed. Thank you very much. We are now going on to Article 2, Finance Committee for a motion. You know, I was going to just make all my announcements about the procedure, and one of them is shutting off your cell phone. So I don't have to say that one. But I would like to review some procedural matters with you, if I may. I hope that everyone has had a chance to review the warrant and familiarize himself or herself with the summary of basic town meeting procedures and the motion primer, which are at the beginning of your warrant on pages Roman numeral 2 and Roman numeral 5. Also, as you've seen, when you raise your card and are recognized, we would appreciate it if you could give your name and address each time you speak in order to assure a clear audio tape record of these proceedings. If you desire to be recognized, please raise your card. Do not stand at the microphone. I will be able to see you in your seat. If you are sitting near a standing mic and I recognize you, you may go over there to speak. Otherwise, please wait for one of our Boy Scout runners to bring you a handheld microphone. The mic will be on. You do not have to blow into it. Just speak. And kindly remember to try and begin with your name and address. We are using runners again because of the long aisles that make it very, very difficult for a voter in the middle to get up to a standing mic. The Boy Scouts tonight are from Troop 63, is that correct? And we have Dylan and his brother Taylor Brown are two of them. We also have, who else do we have over there? We have Andrew, raise your hand please. And Leif, are you here? Can you raise your hand? Leif was with us last year to do the same thing, thank you. All motions of substance, including main motions and motions to amend, shall be delivered to myself and the town clerk in writing before they are made, and then a copy should be given to Mark Thompson at the ViewGraph so he can put it on. When you make a motion or an amendment, you must do so when you are first recognized, and you cannot do it at the end of a statement or a question. Only registered voters of the town and non-resident town and regional school employees may speak without leave of the hall. Non-residents are required to sit in the last two rows to the left or the right. I caution those of you who are here because of a special matter of concern to you not to bolt the hall as soon as you have voted on that matter. You will be showing your neighbors a courtesy by listening to their articles as they have listened to yours. Please be reminded that if you present an article or speak on an article, the bylaw is very clear that you presenters speak for a total of 10 minutes. No matter how many presented there are, the total is still 10 minutes. And speakers may speak only for 5 minutes, and you cannot give, if you wish to speak for less than 5 minutes, you cannot allocate any of your time to someone else. Kindly plan accordingly, as requests to exceed those limits are not granted freely. Having said that, please keep in mind that one of our greatest presidents gave a very persuasive speech in a mere 2 minutes. That would be Abraham Lincoln in 1863, the Gettysburg Address, which historians pretty much agree was one of the most memorable and often quoted speeches of all time. Unless you move in the words of the article as printed in the warrant, every presenter must tell the hall of the word changes in the motion and how they differ from the words that the voters have seen in the warrant. Vote counting in this hall takes considerably longer than it did in the old LS auditorium because of the very long rows with no aisle breaks. So please do not ask for a headcount by tellers unless you are sure that I have miscalculated. I assure you that unless the standing vote is obvious, I will call for a headcount by tellers. If you wish to vote on an article and you are at home watching these proceedings on cable TV, I strongly suggest you leave well before the discussion begins so you have adequate time to park, check in at the tables inside the side doors, and find your way to the auditorium before the doors are locked during the vote count. It would be unfortunate if voters cut it too close and got shut out of the vote. The percentage vote required for passage of an article is set forth in the warrant next to each article. A brief comment for reconsideration, given that it was requested twice by the losing parties at a recent annual town meeting. Both reconsideration votes lost overwhelmingly. There is a very long tradition in Sudbury of only granting reconsideration in very limited circumstances, namely, where there's been such misstatements of fact that enough voters would have voted differently on the original article so as to change the result of that vote. In my 40 years in Sudbury and attending town meeting, I have seen reconsideration succeed less than a handful of times. There are many town meeting attendees who vote in favor of an article that failed, but will still vote against reconsideration of that article. Also, I would ask that there be no clapping, hissing, booing, or other audible noises for or against speakers before, during, or after presentations. Speakers, be they town officials or voters, may not make disrespectful comments, whether directed at a voter, speaker, or town official. If you do, your right to speak may be terminated. My job as moderator is to ensure full and open discussion and fair play on each article. Your job as legislators is to ensure goodwill and respect for differing viewpoints. I now recognize Lawrence O'Brien, Chairman of the Board of Selectmen, for a State of the Town address.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the 370th gathering of Sudbury's annual town meeting. Tonight, we begin this year's town meeting with a tremendous fog of economic uncertainty preventing a clear view of many budget-related items. The current economic conditions are affecting all of us in some way, shape, or form, and that has had a major trickle-down effect on Sudbury's finances. In this current fiscal year that will end on June 30th, we have absorbed $170,000 in mid-year cuts to local aid from the state. Current indications are that additional cuts to this year's state aid are still possible and would further impact our delivery of town and school services. Non-property tax-related local receipts for the current fiscal year are down $200,000 from last year. Snow and ice removal has resulted in a $300,000 deficit that must be made up. Later this evening, the Finance Committee will be asking you to refer the budget to the Board of Selectmen for further study until Monday, May 11th. This postponement will allow town meeting to reconvene at no additional cost when it can give careful and close consideration to a budget that will be built on more reliable information concerning state aid and assorted program funding than currently is available. Why do we need this additional time? So far, the governor's fiscal year 2010 budget is the only one that has been presented. The House will be releasing their budget mid to late April, while the Senate budget is expected mid to late May. In years past, we have always used the governor's budget as the conservative guideline to follow, as the House and Senate budgets have usually been more generous regarding local aid allocations. At this point, the rapidly changing economic conditions make us nervous about considering the governor's budget as a reliable forecast. The House is waiting as long as they possibly can to determine what revenues to the state look like, given that April is the biggest month of the year for tax receipts. Federal stimulus dollars due to Sudbury are still a bit uncertain as to amount and, even more importantly, as to the rules governing their use. The current thinking is that whatever we may receive from the federal government may just as easily be offset by further cuts from the state government. Many of the stimulus dollars may have specific uses or applications tied to them. These use limitations may necessitate that appropriated funds be reappropriated to other specific accounts. While the Sudbury Public Schools and Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School are allowed by statute to move monies around within their budgets, the town is restricted to using money appropriated to particular accounts and line items as they are approved by town meeting. Any changes to the town's budget might require a vote of a special town meeting, and that is an expensive and time-consuming proposition that we believe is unnecessary at this time. The more cost-efficient and better alternative, which we are strongly suggesting, would be to provide the Board of Selectmen and the Finance Committee the next 5 weeks to obtain the best available information from Beacon Hill, with the intention of returning on May 11th to present you with a no-override balanced budget. By then, we will have seen the House's budget, and we will have a better chance of learning of any potential further cuts to state aid. Going forward, over the next few years, it is the opinion of the Board of Selectmen that our fiscal policy and budgeting process must be based on a concept of local sustainability. The likelihood of any additional state aid being distributed to cities and towns during the next few years is not something that the Board of Selectmen and Finance Committee believes we should count on, plan on, or negotiate on. In the end, no matter what the state or federal government does, for our town's fiscal health and ongoing operations. In simple words, the buck stops here. Over the last 20 years, you, the voters and taxpayers of Sudbury, have supported a variety of overrides, but it is the opinion of the Board of Selectmen that we should plan to build our next three budgets going forward based on no override scenarios. Based on the economic uncertainty that we are currently dealing with, it is unwise and misleading, in the opinion of the board, to develop budgets that will result in cuts to critical services if not supported at the ballot box. So what can we do to be locally sustainable? Well, the answer is we can do many things. First, allowing the 5 additional weeks before we vote on any budget may enable negotiations between the town manager and police and fire unions and both school committees with their respective teachers' unions to reach completion, resulting in new 3-year agreements. These agreements are crucial in understanding what Sudbury's cost structure may look like over the next 3 years. Those of you that read the local paper and have followed the budget hearings and selectmen meetings on local cable channels 8 and 31 know that the town and Sudbury Public Schools will be looking to achieve substantial cost savings through implementation of a new health insurance plan that the Board of Selectmen has designed in conjunction with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts. These plans will closely parallel the benefit features that are common in the private sector plans that you are familiar with, as well as many municipal plans, and are more consistent with those of joint purchasing groups, such as the Group Insurance Commission plan, known as the GIC. In addition, negotiations will also include a discussion of revisions to employee contribution levels for their health insurance benefits. The Board of Selectmen have committed to the Sudbury Public School Committee that negotiated savings from changes to health insurance coverages will be returned to the K-8 system so that those savings may be used to preserve jobs that would otherwise be eliminated in the proposed no-override budget. The same scenario would apply to savings achieved by Town Manager Maureen Valente in her negotiations with the various unions she bargains with that serve the town. For those of you that might believe that this requested delay is a tactic to induce an override vote that bolsters the financial resources to be used in negotiations, the Board of Selectmen reiterates its position, as we have previously stated, that we will not support any override until town and school negotiations have been completed and significant changes in contribution structure have been achieved. Other initiatives that will help Sudbury achieve local sustainability: continued development of maximum spending caps as originally proposed by the Finance Committee prior to last year's town meeting and reiterated by them last November, in concert with the Board of Selectmen's desire to develop a long-term financial plan that will look forward over the next 5 to 10 years and plan ahead for capital expenditures, infrastructure improvements, and physical plant and building maintenance. Many of you are aware of the recent reports generated by the Budget Review Task Force, a committee made up of town board members and volunteers from the community that had financial and managerial experience and expertise. It is appropriate that we publicly thank the members of this committee who gave an enormous amount of time and effort to develop recommendations on behalf of the taxpayers and residents of Sudbury. Many of the ideas or concepts that I am about to mention are in the Budget Review Task Force reports that have been submitted to the Board of Selectmen, and they are posted and available on the town's website. Other ideas have been actively discussed and worked on by the Board of Selectmen and other committees prior to the formation of the Budget Review Task Force, and were reinforced as viable ideas through the work of the task force. Regionalization. In our first endeavor, we have reached an agreement to share the position of Park and Rec Director with Wayland. The savings are enough to preserve one position within the town's budget. The Wayland and Sudbury Boards of Selectmen are in discussions and are investigating the possibility of sharing specialized DPW equipment, transfer stations, senior centers, and library facilities. Wayland and Sudbury are also in discussion to investigate the potential additional revenue that may be generated, that may be garnered by generating electricity from our combined landfills through a combination of methane collection and solar power generation created by installing photovoltaic panels on top of the capped landfills. Consolidation of the school administration is something that we will be moving forward with. On April 9th, 3 days from this evening, the working group that has been established by the Board of Selectmen in Sudbury in conjunction with Selectman Gary Taylor of Lincoln will begin meeting on a regular basis to research and vet the various options of administrative consolidation with the intention of submitting an article, if warranted, to both the Lincoln and Sudbury town meetings for approval next year in 2010. The working group is comprised of members from Lincoln and Sudbury representing all of the stakeholders that would be affected by any changes made through administrative consolidation. Other Budget Review Task Force recommendations to generate revenue or reduce expenses will be prioritized by the Board of Selectmen at our April 28th meeting. A meeting with all the members of the task force is being scheduled for May 12th at 8 p.m. At this meeting, we will be establishing working groups charging them with further researching and developing selected recommendations for revenue creation and cost savings into viable suggestions that have the potential to enhance our local fiscal sustainability. In conclusion, if we had the winning Megabucks ticket, we would have already cashed it in. Unfortunately, we don't. Our only other option is to come together as a community and continue to work hard within Sudbury in collaborative ways to find cost savings and additional revenues so that Sudbury will remain the tremendous place to live that it already is. Is this a challenging task? You bet it is. All of us, being open to changing the way our town and schools have operated in the past, will be critical to our future success, if we're able to have any at all. Many of the 2,408 people that took time to vote last Monday in Sudbury sent a message that supported change in ways that would preserve town and school services and our outstanding quality of life through means and mechanisms that go beyond overrides or layoffs as being the only answers. The Board of Selectmen believe that the toolbox that will deliver the necessary changes has been enhanced by the work of the Budget Review Task Force and the leadership of the Finance Committee to bring discussion of our structural deficit and growth in spending to the forefront of community dialogue. Many of the tools required to build and strengthen our local sustainability have been identified, and the Board of Selectmen anticipates that additional new tools will be added to the collection as this crucial work begins. Now is the time for the Board of Selectmen and both school committees to reach out and work with our citizens and employees alike to set the course towards local sustainability. As this economic fog begins to lift, Sudbury will emerge stronger and in a better position to face the future if we seize these opportunities today. The Board of Selectmen looks forward to your continued support in these challenging times. Thank you.
I understand that the Finance Committee will wait until the budget article to make its statement on the town's financial condition. With that, we now turn to Article 2, and we look to the Finance Committee for a motion under Article 2. The chair is Charles Woodard.
Chuck Woodard, Chair of the Finance Committee. Move to refer Article 2 to the Board of Selectmen to determine the effect of the state budget relative to state aid to Sudbury and to report back to this annual town meeting at an adjourned session on May 11th, 2009 for further action on this article.
Does that receive a second? It does. Finance Committee for a presentation.
The Finance Committee recommends the consideration of all of the budget-related articles, that's 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, be postponed until May 11th. However, I will make these remarks only one time. We have concerns about the fiscal year 2009 budget due to revenue uncertainties. The state could still reduce fourth quarter state aid amounts, and the town's local receipts have been lagging below estimates. We may need to take further action under this Article 2 fiscal year 09 budget adjustments later in May. Regarding fiscal year 10, the estimates of revenue and expense that form the budget are still subject to meaningful adjustment. As to the revenues, we do not have state aid and federal stimulus dollar amounts in which we can have a high level of confidence. The state budget's not yet finalized. State aid amounts previously estimated for Sudbury could be reduced as a result of the continuing very bleak news regarding state tax revenues. And in addition, even though there are federal stimulus dollars available, the rules surrounding the use of those funds are still not yet fully understood, so we don't know how they can be applied. As to expenses, collective bargaining with the town and school labor unions for new three-year contracts are still ongoing. And without knowing the details of these agreements, particularly the breakdown of wages and health insurance, we cannot know what the full cost and personnel impact to the budget will be. This additional 5 weeks postponement may hopefully bring us closer to having that information. And let me reiterate what the Board of Selectmen Chairman said. This is not an attempt to improve the chances of an override. That has absolutely nothing to do with the Finance Committee's recommendation. We are very worried that state revenues we expect for fiscal year 10 could be reduced, in which case the proposed non-override budget that you see in the warrant would not be balanced. We need more time because we need more certainty around revenues and expenses next year before we can, with any degree of confidence, recommend a budget to you. Thank you.
Selectman?
Selectman, accept the referral and support the motion as made.
Do I understand it that this motion to refer to the selectmen will occur on Articles 2 through 8?
Correct.
Thank you. Anybody wish to be heard on this Article 2 motion to refer? Yes, all the way on the side there.
Robert Stein, 7 Thompson Drive. So that the taxpayers have a clear view and complete transparency, could we get an assurance that if we do approve the delay till May 11th, that the taxpayers could see online the contract negotiations?
Okay. Town manager, Town Council. Town Council for an answer.
No, the answer is no. The negotiations will not be public or publicized. It's my understanding that your question is, will they be publicized?
No, if the contracts are complete and signed, can the taxpayers see a copy of the completed and signed contracts?
Oh, of course.
So you can get assurance public you can record. Put them online?
I
Town Manager.
Just, I can only speak from the town perspective. Once we have an agreement, we end up with what's called a memorandum of understanding. And so when that's a finished document, I think that can be put online. But we don't end up incorporating all those changes into the contract for quite a while afterwards. It takes a while going back and forth to actually put it in the contract. But the MOU, Paul, I wouldn't think there'd be a problem with before that. If once the board, it's been accepted by all parties.
Okay, excellent. Could we
I'm just saying that for the town. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
what
can we get that assurance from SPS and LS too?
We're going to try. SPS, Susan or John, the question is not the negotiations, but after the negotiations are complete and the contract's been signed, would you put that online?
Our situation is similar to what Maureen Valenti just described, that there'll be a memorandum of understanding that would be available and that. But it does.
The answer is yes.
I haven't gotten all the way to the end.
Yes, Lincoln Sudbury.
And then from the Lincoln Sudbury School Committee, also the answer is yes. Once we reach a memorandum of understanding, it will be available online.
The answer is yes for the town and both schools.
How much time in advance could we have prior to the May 11th?
I assume the answer to that is it correct, as soon as the negotiation is completed and an MOU is signed?
I think, yeah, all we could say is if it's done in time, then it can be available. If it's not, it can't.
Okay. Yes, over there, please, stand up.
Terry Lynn, 164 Maynard Farm Road. I guess my question is, what point would it serve to have a meeting on the 11th if these negotiations aren't complete, number one? And number two, would there be another warrant published or a revised budget or something that would be put out in paper form, or would this be online?
Somebody from either the town manager's office or the FinCom care to answer that question?
No, there would not be a revised budget. We're still within the same town meeting, so it's the same existing warrant. If there are numbers that would change things, I think we could look at trying to post them on the town's website as to what sort of the revision vis-a-vis what's printed in the warrant, if it moves things around, certainly if that's done in time. It'd be the budget's the finance committee is what they're presenting, so that would be up to them, but if it's done and it's ready to be put on the town website, I'm okay with that.
If negotiations aren't completed by the 11th, we have no reason to change what you see in the warrant. The one thing we might change in the warrant would be if we know state aid is going to be less than we anticipated, then we would have to publish a budget with lower state aid and therefore a lower no override budget. But we wouldn't, with absent completion of negotiation, certainly the Finance Committee has no plans to change the budget beyond that.
Yes.
Tammy Dufault, 84 Silver Hill. One of the things that I recall, and I don't remember whether it was at the budget presentations or not, was that FinCom was hesitant to approve the budget because they didn't know where the money was going to be spent. If come May 11th we don't have signed contracts, how can FinCom support a budget if we don't know where the money is going to be spent? So, again, I guess I would go back to the question. If we don't have contracts on May 11th, how can we approve this?
Well, we have to have a budget for next year. Let's start with that. And we're certainly not going to recommend or even consider any kind of an override unless we know where the money would go. And absent the completion of contract negotiations, we won't know that. But in the meantime, we at least have to provide the town with a budget so it can operate next year. And I assume if negotiations are not completed, and as I understand it, the unions can continue to operate under the existing agreement, which means, I gather, that the step increases go forward, there are no COLAs, and all the other rules surrounding the contract continue as is, to the extent that the no override budget doesn't pay for the same number of employees given those pay raises, then there will be layoffs right away.
Hang on a minute. You have a follow-up question?
That does make sense, and I appreciate the feedback there. So I guess if we go back to this and we're looking at whether we have contracts or not, I think maybe one of the questions that we're all curious about, is there an objective on when the contracts will be finished? I know that's a negotiation process, but since we're kind of, you know, working backwards from May 11th, is there kind of a community objective in finishing these contracts?
Yes, Mr. O'Brien.
Speaking in general terms, Mr. Faltz, everyone, all negotiating parties are doing the best they can, but it obviously takes both sides to come together. We would very much, the Board of Selectmen would very much like to see contracts reached and completed prior to the 11th, but as Mr. Woodard said, we must have a balanced budget ready to go for July 1st by statute, or the town will cease to run.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard under this Article 2? Yes. Right.
Robert Coe, 14 Churchill Street. Since the FinCom brought it up, I understand the logic in postponing Articles 2 and 4 and maybe one or two others. But what's the point of postponing the enterprise fund articles? Aren't they revenue neutral?
Town manager?
The benefits for the enterprise funds are voted under Article 4, and then there's a transfer done, so there is the linking together of these matters that are with that, so they should be done as a package. And then the last one there, Article 8, is really not dependent on Article 4. There's no benefits anticipated in there, but I think the thinking was, is a package to consider all of these finances together made sense rather than splitting off one of them. But that's the reason for the enterprise funds.
Anybody else wish to be heard on this motion to refer on to Article 2? Yes, way in the back there, please stand up.
Brian Temple, 15 Revere Road. I'd just like to build on Mr. Stein's question. I heard you say you'd post the memorandum of understanding for the contract. So follow-on question, will you then post the completed contracts once they're done? And second question, you've never posted the current contracts, so it's impossible to go online today and find out exactly what the current contracts call for across all the towns, unions, SPS, and LS. I'd like to be able to see those so we can compare what we've been negotiated going forward. So will you commit to, once the completed contracts are done, will you commit to, over the next couple of days, posting the current contracts?
Yes, town manager.
I think we could post some of them in terms of calling it current, though. For instance, we settled so late with fire and police, and I think Assistant Town Manager Walker can correct me if I'm wrong. Some of those, all those changes have not been put into the contract itself. We start operating off the MOU. So I think the MOU could, the prior MOU, and we could put the most recent contract version that we have, and then when it's finished, be able to put that up when we have somebody who can scan them in, because they don't necessarily originate on our computer. Sometimes they're on the union lawyer's computer, and so we don't have the Word version. But to the extent we have something,
I'll scan them for you.
We can do that.
I'll scan them for you.
Might take you up on it.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard?
We haven't heard from SPS or LS yet.
I'm sorry?
SPS or LS hasn't weighed in yet.
Okay. SPS will post them. And how about LS? Yes for them, too. Yes for all three cost centers. Any other questions on the Article 2? I see none. All those in favor of the motion, as you see on the view graph, please signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it requires a majority vote, and I see one negative vote, so it passes overwhelmingly. By the way, every one of these motions to refer on Articles 3 through 8 will all be a majority vote. FinCom for a motion to Article 3.
Move to refer Article 3 to the Board of Selectmen to determine the effect of the state budget relative to state aid to Sudbury and to report back to this annual town meeting at an adjourned session on May 11, 2009 for further action on this article.
Is there a second? There is. FinCom for a presentation. Unless you want to say the same as in Article 2.
Same as in Article 2.
One of the greatest presentations ever. Selectmen.
We support.
Selectmen say the same thing. This is great. Anybody who wishes to be heard under Article 3? I see no. All those in favor of the motion on the view graph signify by raising your cards. Thank you. Those opposed? All but one are in favor. Article 4, FinCom.
Move to refer Article 4 to the Board of Selectmen to determine the effect of the state budget relative to state aid to Sudbury and to report back to this annual town meeting at an adjourned session on May 11, 2009 for further action on this article.
Does that receive a second? It does. FinCom, same report. Selectmen, same report.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 4? Yes, right over there, please stand.
Mr. Moderator, Helen Casey, 85 Poconoket. Shouldn't the word adjourned be reconvened session?
No. You can adjourn a session. For example, if we meet tomorrow night, we will be adjourning at the end of tonight, as opposed to dissolving the town meeting.
Yes, but when we gather again, aren't we reconvening?
No, it's part of it's no different than meeting tomorrow night. Meeting on May 11th is no different than meeting tomorrow night.
Thank you.
By the way, I'm glad you asked. Thank you for the question. When we go to adjourn after we finish all 32 articles, I will call for a motion to adjourn to May 11th at 7:30 here.
Thank you.
Anyone else wish to be heard on the motion under Article 4 that's on the view graph? Seeing none, all those in favor, raise your cards. All those opposed, all but one in favor. Article 5, FinCom.
Move to refer Article 5 to the Board of Selectmen to determine the effect of the state budget relative to state aid to Sudbury and to report back to this annual town meeting at an adjourned session on May 11, 2009 for further action on this article.
Does that receive a second? It does. FinCom, same. Selectmen, same. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 5? Seeing none, all those in favor, raise your cards. All those opposed, all but one are in favor. Article 6, FinCom.
Move to refer Article 6 to the Board of Selectmen to determine the effect of the state budget relative to state aid to Sudbury and to report back to this annual town meeting and an adjourned session on May 11, 2009 for further action on this article.
Does that receive a second? It does. Finance Committee, same report. Selectmen, same report. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 6? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? Although everyone is in favor except there's one opposed, that means that Articles 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 have all passed. Article 7, Finance Committee.
Move to refer Article 7 to the Board of Selectmen to determine the effect of the state budget relative to state aid to Sudbury and to report back to this annual town meeting at an adjourned session on May 11, 2009 for further action on this article.
Does that receive a second? It does. Finance Committee report the same? Selectmen the same? Thank you. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 7? I see none. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? All are in favor but one. That means it passes. Article 8, FinCom.
Move to refer Article 8 to the Board of Selectmen to determine the effect of the state budget relative to state aid to Sudbury and to report back to this annual town meeting at an adjourned session on May 11, 2009 for further action on this article.
Does that receive a second? It does. FinCom the same? Selectmen the same? Anybody wish to be heard on Article 8? I see none. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? That is a unanimous vote, which means it passes. We're on to Article 9. Barbara Chisholm, the town accountant, will make a motion.
Every year this article is presented at town meeting.
Barbara, you have to start out with the motion.
Oh, Article 9.
Barbara, do you have the motion in front of you?
I'll move to indefinitely postpone consideration on Article 9.
Does that receive a second? It does. Barbara's now going to tell us why we should indefinitely postpone Article 9.
Every year this article is presented at town meeting in case a prior year bill is submitted for payment. A prior year bill cannot be paid out of the current year's budget without prior town meeting approval. There are no unpaid bills to report for FY09.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 9? I see none. All those in favor of indefinite postponement signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? It is a unanimous vote. It passes. Article 10 was on the consent calendar. Article 11 was on the consent calendar. Article 12 passed on the consent calendar. Article 13, motion by the Selectman Drabinski under Article 13.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Vote to establish a septage facility operating enterprise fund commencing July 1, 2009 to be expended under the direction of the town manager for the purpose of the town of Sudbury's financial management of operations and capital improvement budget for the Wayland Sudbury Septage Facility to be funded by the receipts of the operation and to accept provisions of Massachusetts General Law, Chapter 40, Section 53F and a half, insofar as necessary for the establishment of said fund and to appropriate the sum of $766,308 for the septic facility operating expenses fund for FY 2010, and said sum to be raised from the $766,308 in receipts of the enterprise fund.
Does that receive a second? It does. Selectman Drabinski.
There's a great report and a warrant, but I just want to give some headlines from the report and the warrant. Basically, this continues what Selectman O'Brien talked about, the relationship between Sudbury and Wayland to share services and look at ways to save taxpayers' money. Secondly, it provides for a consolidated financial services between the town of Sudbury and Wayland. And third, it will not cost the taxpayers of Sudbury a single dollar since the enterprise fund takes care of the operation. So we urge your support for this enterprise fund. Thank you.
Finance Committee, Debbie Zirka.
The Finance Committee recommends approval of this article.
Thank you. I assume the Selectmen recommend approval. Thank you. And Andrea Turkelson for a presentation, our Financial Director.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Since this is a new topic for town meeting, we wanted to give some background to everyone. The Wayland Sudbury Septage Facility operates pursuant to a June 4, 1997 intermunicipal agreement between two towns. Financial management responsibilities have historically been split between Wayland and Sudbury. The Septage Committee recently issued an RFP to provide consolidated financial services in a single host town. Sudbury's proposal has been accepted by the committee, and that's why we're here before you this evening. Wayland is responsible currently for the vendor accounting and bill paying functions, while Sudbury's been responsible for pumper invoicing and payment receipt processing. In addition, the Septage Committee has retained a private CPA to merge the financial reports for Sudbury and Wayland and separately contract for audits on an annual basis. Approval for Article 13 provides legal authority for Sudbury to establish a septage facility operating enterprise fund as the host town. It authorizes Sudbury's town manager to manage and maintain septage facility financial records. And more importantly, it consolidates and streamlines septage facility financial accounting. The financial accounting functions. It does not incur any additional costs to the town of Sudbury. And then we have a slide here. This is directly from the Wayland warrant. This is typically what the town of Wayland would be putting before town meeting and having voted. As you can see, the requested fiscal 2010 has a total operating budget of $766,308. Recommending approval, Article 13 will improve the efficiency and timeliness of its financial operations, and as mentioned before, the Board of Selectmen unanimously supports approval for Article 13.
Thank you. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 13? No, I see no hands. All those in favor of the article, as it appears on the view graph, signify by raising your cards. Those opposed? Sir, were you opposed, or you just didn't lower your card quickly? I'm going to call that a unanimous vote. It passes. That was Article 13. Article 14 was on the consent calendar. Article 15 was on the consent calendar. Article 16. Article 16. Larry O'Brien, Selectman, for a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Article 16, the motion is to indefinitely postpone.
Does that receive a second? It does. Would you explain that to us, Mr. O'Brien?
Yes, Mr. Moderator. The land mentioned in the article off Hudson Road we have communicated with some of the abutters. There has been an interest expressed in a return letter of some of the abutters to potentially buy the land, and the Selectmen feel at this time it would be best to continue negotiations. If they're successful, it'll produce a small amount of revenue for the town. If unsuccessful, we'll bring the articles back next year.
Thank you. And that's a report of the Board of Selectmen.
Yes, it is.
Thank you. Finance Committee, Jamie Gossels.
Finance Committee recommends indefinite postponement.
Thank you. Anybody wish to be heard on the motion for indefinite postponement under Article 16? I see none. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it is unanimous, and it passes, as did the prior article. We are now on to Article 17. Selectman O'Brien.
Motion is to indefinitely postpone, Mr. Moderator.
Does that receive a second? It does. Selectman O'Brien.
Same report as previously, Mr. Moderator.
Thank you. Jamie Gossels.
Finance Committee recommends approval.
Finance Committee recommends approval. Anybody wish to be heard on the motion for indefinite postponement on Article 17? I see none. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? The vote is unanimous and it passes. Article 18 was on the consent calendar. It has been removed by debate. So we will now hear by Fire Chief Ken McLean to make a motion.
Ken McLean, Fire Chief. I move to amend the Town of Sudbury Bylaws, Article 5D, Fire Alarm System, Section 6, by adding thereto the words, except as otherwise authorized by the Fire Chief, at the beginning of the first sentence, and the words without authorization in the second sentence, so that the section shall read as follows. Shall I read it?
Yes.
Except as otherwise authorized by the fire chief, no fire alarm system shall be equipped with a tape dialer or similar automatic telephone device, which will transmit an alarm message to any telephone lines of the SFD.
Excuse me, Chief?
Yes.
I'm sorry for interrupting. Are you reading exactly what was in the warrant?
Yes.
Including the beginning, the motion itself?
I believe I read it.
Anyone whoever's drawing these motions, is there any difference between the motion that appears in the warrant and the motion that appears what Chief McLean is reading? Because if there is no difference, he can just move in the words of the article. Can someone answer that question for me? Fine. Chief, why don't you move in the words of the article? And you agreeing to withdraw everything else you said and just move in the words of the article?
I withdraw and I move in the words of the article.
Does that receive a second? Thank you. Chief, for an explanation. Thank you.
Thank you. This proposed language change provides a foundation for the Sudbury Fire Department to provide alarm monitoring services for residents and businesses for a fee, shortening response times and bringing much-needed revenue into the department. Years ago, residents were free to program automatic dialers to call the fire department whenever their fire alarms would activate. But with the proliferation of systems, a Sudbury bylaw was passed prohibiting this practice and forcing residents to hire commercial services to monitor their alarms for a monthly fee. In doing so, some delay is now experienced in receiving calls as alarms are transmitted to a distant location where a commercial service first validates the emergency and then calls us if the emergency is real. Validation is accomplished by calling the residents and asking if there is a problem, getting a confirming passcode, and then terminating the call if no emergency exists, or calling the fire department if there is an emergency. If we pass this proposed language change, the fire chief will have the opportunity, but not the obligation, to allow direct connection of fire alarm systems to the Sudbury Fire Department. With our own commercial and emergency dispatchers sitting in the same room in Sudbury, we could reduce the time from initial call to delivery of emergency services by eliminating the middleman while capturing substantial revenue in the process. A typical alarm monitoring company charges between $25 and $50 per month, and with nearly 6,000 homes in Sudbury, the potential revenue for 100% penetration could be $3.6 million annually. Obviously, that is grossly optimistic. But even capturing a small portion would be significant and would fund a modern dispatch center, improve response times, and improve quality of service. In addition, as we potentially move towards combined dispatch in the future, this will give us new tools and flexibility. There are models of this service being provided by the fire industry. Cedar Hills, Texas, serves an area of three towns and a population of 125,000. They have been operating for 2 years and now have 200 clients, charging $25 per month, bringing in $60,000 per year. They are hampered in their growth due to legislation that prohibits them from advertising in Texas. I am not aware of any similar law prohibiting that in Massachusetts. A question may arise as to whether the public sector should be in competition with the private sector. In fact, the Sudbury Fire Department abandoned monitoring to private vendors years ago while still remaining the ultimate point of contact for emergency service. This proposal provides language that can reclaim that which was formerly ours, while at the same time giving our residents better response times as witnessed by the Cedar Hills experience. In Cedar Hills, Texas, response times have been reduced by up to 5 minutes for their clients since inception of their program. Please vote favorably to provide us the opportunity to more fully investigate the potential for revenue dispatch in Sudbury.
Thank you, Chief. The Finance Committee reports that it takes no position on this article.
Actually, the Finance Committee recommends approval of this article.
I stand corrected. Bill Keller for the Selectmen.
And the Selectmen unanimously recommend approval. It's a good example of how our employees look for better ways to provide better service and also generate additional revenues.
Thank you. Anybody wish to be heard? Yes, Mr. Coe.
Robert Coe, 14 Churchill Street. I was the one that held the article. I don't have any problem with putting the particular words into the bylaw that are proposed. I think probably the current bylaw is too restrictive in that respect as it is. I don't have any problem with the fire department going into competition, either real or imagined, with the private sector. What does concern me about this is this. The language does not create revenue dispatch, but only sets the foundation for future consideration. This term, revenue dispatch, is not defined in the article, as far as I can see, and it seems to me to be pretty open-ended. I would bitterly regret it if at some time in the future we could point back to an action taken tonight as being the beginning of a justification, say, to start charging for 911 calls. I think that this reminds me too much of the thin end of the wedge. It's not that I don't like the way the motion is phrased. I don't like the commentary that goes with it and the potential implications. So I'd love to have somebody put my mind at rest, tell me that I'm all wet and that nothing along those lines could ever possibly happen.
Thank you. Chief McLean, to try and address your question.
That won't ever happen. If it would calm your mind, we could call it commercial dispatch as opposed to revenue dispatch. But charging for 911 is antithetical to the whole principle of public safety.
Thank you. Yes, Mike, over here, please.
Carolyn Lee, 28 Mossman Road. As I read this, I was thinking about our contract, which goes directly to the fire department without going a long distance, and only burglary type, those kind of alarms go through a central thing. And it's for that combined service of breaking in and fire that we pay a fee that is in that range. So it seems to me like this makes some presumptions about what one service is and says we can't have the fire anymore without going and getting special permission, but we're still going to get to pay our vendor the same amount of, our other vendor the same amount of money. I don't see how that helps me out.
Chief McLean.
If I understand your statement and then your following question, you're presently connected directly to the fire department. We don't have any residences presently connected directly to the fire department. They all go through monitoring companies.
The monitoring company has told us that they don't, when a fire department thing one comes in, a fire one comes in, they don't even pick it up. They just refer it. So it's directly forwarded. There is no human. There is no callback.
I can't speak to the practices and protocols of all of the individual companies, but to address the second part of your question as to fire and burglars together, as this process goes forward, there would also be in future years a change to police prohibitions against direct dialers so that we could work together to provide both burglar and fire monitoring systems.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 18? Yes.
Steve Lansendorf, 43 Hawes Road. Chief, you mentioned that you did monitor once upon a time and stopped. Do you have any perspective on why that happened?
We monitored many, many years ago, and actually we still do monitor commercial fire alarm boxes. They do come directly to the station, but not residences. And we stopped monitoring residences just because of the volume of calls was interfering with our emergency dispatch. The principle here is to generate revenue so that we can hire additional personnel to provide commercial dispatch sitting next to the emergency dispatch people, so decreasing the time between the initiation of the call and our response, as well as bringing revenue into the department.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be have any questions or wish to be heard on Article 18? Yes, stand up, please.
Kathy Jacob, 328 Old Lancaster Road. You said that you, the method now is that the commercial companies screen. Will you screen prior to getting in your fire engine and coming out to see us?
We will do some of the same screening. For instance, if there is a smoke detector activation, there will be screening that's taking place. But our commercial dispatch will be sitting right next to our emergency dispatcher, and so there can be a heads-up going on at the same time that validation is going on, indicating that maybe this is the time to get the fire truck rolling, even while we're validating the call.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, right behind you, Kathy. Just pass the mic behind you.
Hi, Jennifer Bott, 7 South Meadow Drive. I'm sorry to beat a dead horse, but I just want to be clear here. Did this article result in double paying so that if we have an alarm system that monitors burglary and fire, that we would not be permitted to go through our private third party, and we would have to go through the Town of Sudbury Fire Department. And then if the Town of Sudbury Police Department takes over, then we pay the Town of Sudbury Police Department. But until then, we're paying both?
No. It is not the intent that there be any double billing. You would choose under the projected program that we're just beginning to investigate, and beginning to investigate by allowing this language to be proposed, you would simply choose Sudbury as your vendor, or another vendor, as you may presently do. But Sudbury could just be another on the menu of vendors that you could choose to monitor your alarm system.
But does Sudbury have to approve the other vendor? Because now the language in the bylaw contains the word prohibited. So that sort of suggests that I would need permission to use someone other than Sudbury. Is that correct?
The language in the article, as it presently stands, without the modifications we're talking about tonight, talk about direct dial, direct tape dialers. A dialer that you would attach to your phone in your home that would directly dial the fire department. That is presently prohibited. The central station, ADT, all of the vendors are not prohibited from calling us any more than you are from calling us from your home saying, I have a fire or an emergency in my house.
Thank you very much.
Ma'am, can I just have your address for the record?
7 South Meadow Drive. 7 South Meadow Drive.
Thank you very much. Anybody else wish to be heard? Yes, right here. We have a mic.
Barbara Pryor, 221 Knobscot Road. A question for you. You talked about having a second person there as sort of a commercial dispatcher. At some point, you're going to have to hire this person. At what point do you have enough people who are paying you to offset the cost of hiring this person that you're going to have as a second dispatcher? And what happens to the people who pay for the service before you've hired the second dispatcher who is going to sit side by side with the emergency dispatcher?
The revenue that we propose to generate from the from monthly billings would offset the cost of hiring additional dispatchers to provide the service. I didn't understand the second part of your question.
The second part of the question was, at what point do you have enough revenue to hire this second dispatcher, and what happens to the people who have signed up for this service before you actually have hired the second dispatcher?
We won't start providing the service until we have sufficient personnel to provide the service to the extent that it should be.
Okay. So you wouldn't actually institute the service until you had enough people signed up to pay to offset the cost of the additional dispatcher?
Well, let me back up a little bit. It's important to understand that the purpose of this language change tonight is that we're not tomorrow going into this business. We're just opening the door to see if the town has an appetite for investigating this. And if we can change this, that gives the fire chief the opportunity, but not the obligation, to provide this service, then it is a clear heads up that we're headed in the right direction and we should investigate so that we can answer those questions more clearly for you.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 18? Can you stand up, please? Yes, can we have a mic there?
Todd Faber, 96 Ford Road. I commend the fact that you guys are thinking outside the box and trying to come up with alternative revenue, but wouldn't it have made more sense in terms of looking at this from a bigger picture and a real revenue driver, given the fact that people who are using alarm systems are doing it for burglary and fire at the same time that the police department have engaged in the same action by trying to amend the bylaws? In the sense that we could run parallel tracks, because it's unlikely that people would just pursue one without pursuing both.
We will not proceed with this unless at next year's town meeting we can also amend, assuming that we pass this tonight, that we also amend the police bylaw. Prior to Chief Fadgen's retirement, he and I discussed this, and he was in favor of it at that time. But this is just sort of a leader to get out there and see if there is an appetite for this.
No, I understand that. I'm just saying, wouldn't it have made sense, though, to do both at the same time instead of waiting an additional year to look at generating new revenue?
That is true. There was a deadline for filing articles for this year. The police article did not get filed prior to the deadline.
Thank you. Yes. Could you wait for the mic, please? Thank you.
Ron Brumback, 36 Canterbury Drive. Just a question. Why is it that you can't just go ahead and investigate this? Why do you need to change the language before you investigate and determine feasibility?
I have been investigating this and looking at the feasibility. I think it is feasible. That's where I brought the language forward. There's a starting point, and this is the starting point from putting it out there in front of the town and giving you an opportunity to digest it and see if it's something you want to pursue.
Anybody else wish to be heard? Yes, over there. Question has been called. Does it receive a second? It does. Does anyone have any new information to add to this who hasn't been heard from yet? I see one hand. Okay. Please consider that when you vote. This requires a two-thirds vote. All those in favor of the call to question signify by raising your cards. Those opposed, it receives well more than two-thirds. We'll go on to the motion as appeared. It's moving in the words of the article, Article 18 in your warrant. All those in favor of Article 18 signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it receives well more than a majority, and therefore it passes. We will move on to Article 19, where Lisa Eggleston, the Planning Board Vice Chair, will make a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. I move in the words of the article.
Does that receive a second? It does. Presentation, please.
While we're getting this set up, I would just like to say that while it may be apropos to the subject we're discussing tonight, I have nothing to do with tonight's weather. Okay. You may be wondering why Sudbury even needs a stormwater bylaw. The answer to that question is twofold. First, it is required under our federal NPDES permit. Under the Clean Water Act, all point source discharges of pollution are required to be covered by NPDES permits, a permit program administered by the EPA. Since 2003, operators of publicly owned drainage systems located in an urban area, as defined by the 2000 census, have been considered point source discharges of pollution and subject to the NPDES Phase 2 stormwater permitting program. Sudbury is among 242 communities in Massachusetts that are covered by the Phase 2 general stormwater permit. These are the communities that are shown in pink on this slide. It's a little difficult to see. Whoops, especially since I don't have the right slide. Sorry. Those are the communities shown in pink. It's a little difficult to tell, but they're primarily in the eastern portion of the state, the more urbanized areas. This permit requires us to develop a stormwater management plan addressing six minimum control measures, including such things as mapping our storm drains, educating the public about preventing stormwater pollution, and making sure that we have municipal operations in place to reduce stormwater pollution. As part of these measures, municipalities must develop and adopt, or already have in place, bylaws, ordinances, or other regulatory mechanisms to control sources of pollutants entering the municipal storm drain system. Massachusetts already has some of the most stringent stormwater management standards in the country as part of the Wetlands Protection Act. This basically requires us to apply similar standards to projects that are not within Wetlands Protection Act jurisdiction. The adoption of a bylaw is an effective and commonly used means of accomplishing these objectives. As of a year ago, about 45% of Massachusetts municipalities regulated under Phase 2 had already adopted bylaws or other regulatory mechanisms to control runoff from development projects, and another 30% were in the process of drafting them. I suspect, therefore, that many other town meetings across the state are looking at adopting similar bylaws this year. The second and perhaps more important reason, though, that we're proposing this bylaw tonight is that we have valuable water resources here in Sudbury that we need to protect. Now, most of you at one time or another learned about the water cycle. Put simply, when it rain falls on the land, some of it runs off of the surface. This is the stormwater. And some of it infiltrates into the ground, replenishing aquifers and making its way slowly towards the rivers. But when the land is urbanized and covered with impervious surfaces, such as pavement and rooftops, less water is able to infiltrate into the ground, and more of it becomes runoff, which can lead to flooding. In addition, the loss of infiltration can deplete groundwater supplies and base flow to rivers. This is the Ipswich River up in the area of Reading, looking very similar to that shot I showed you earlier of the Sudbury River. However, this is the Ipswich River during a dry spell in the summer. Unfortunately, this has become a common summer occurrence in that river basin, attributed largely to the loss of stormwater infiltration in the watershed. This same thing is beginning to happen in the upper Charles River basin, and it could happen here on the Sudbury River if we in the towns upstream don't take steps now to maintain recharge. In addition to the quantitative impacts, when stormwater runs off of the ground surface, it basically washes off whatever pollutants it comes in contact with, such as litter, sand and silt, excess fertilizer, and the like. Since the runoff is generally transported untreated to the nearest water body, the result is not always positive. Excess nutrient loading can lead to algal blooms. And certainly from an aesthetic and wildlife habitat, this is more valuable than this. It is also important to note that in Sudbury, our water supply is derived solely from groundwater wells, the largest of which draw water from under our commercial district located along Route 20. Route 20 bisects pretty much that red area that you see there that is the well withdrawal area. If we want to maintain high-quality drinking water, it's therefore in our best interest to implement wise stormwater management practices in these watersheds. So, unless you're ready to vote now, let me tell you about the bylaw. First of all, its development was a joint effort by representatives of the Planning Board, Conservation Commission, Board of Health, and Department of Public Works, in cooperation with the Metropolitan Area Planning Council, who provided technical assistance to the Massachusetts Environmental Trust-funded Sustainable Water Resources Project. It is based on a state model bylaw that has been modified and used in a number of other municipalities. And it addresses the requirements for both construction site runoff controls and post-development runoff controls stipulated in the Phase 2 NPDES permit. The bylaw will be administered by the Planning Board and will apply fundamental stormwater management standards to all new development and redevelopment projects except those that fall below the thresholds established. These exemptions would include most work on single-family lots, such as additions, expanded driveways, and the like, as well as agricultural activities and landscape maintenance. Certain activities, such as mounded septic systems, would be regulated in order to avoid runoff from steep grades onto abutting properties. The bylaw establishes two levels of permitting for development and redevelopment projects that exceed the thresholds established. Those disturbing a relatively small area or having a small potential impact, such as those listed here, will be covered under a general permit. These projects would require no application fee and no public hearing, and they would only need to comply with the basic stormwater management standards that will be laid out in the regulations currently being developed. This includes taking steps to maximize infiltration on site, prevent soil erosion, and the like. The second level of permitting would be for larger projects and those with more potential to impact stormwater, such as multi-lot subdivisions, clearing on steep slopes, or larger commercial projects. and these would be reviewed and permitted on an individual basis. We anticipate that most of these permits will be for activities on the commercial properties along Route 20. I do want to emphasize that this is not a prohibitive bylaw. It will just apply the same level of stormwater regulation as is currently applied in areas subject to Wetlands Protection Act jurisdiction. The Planning Board is quite cognizant of development constraints along Route 20 and has worked hard to balance the issues of resource protection and economic development. For redevelopment projects, the performance standard will be to require some improvement over existing conditions. Finally, for projects within Wetlands Protection Act jurisdiction, the bylaw allows the Planning Board to delegate the permitting authority to the Conservation Commission in order to avoid redundancy and streamline the permitting process. We are in the process of developing regulations, and pending passage of this article tonight, anticipate that the Planning Board and Conservation Commission would hold a joint public hearing to review the proposed regulations within the next several months. In summary, Article 19 presents a bylaw that meets the requirements of our federal NPDES permit, protects and preserves our groundwater and surface water resources, is the product of a collaborative effort of a number of town boards, and has the support of several others. We urge your support as well. Thank you.
Finance Committee?
Finance Committee takes no position on this article.
And Selectman?
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Board of Selectmen urges support through this article to protect Sudbury's environmental quality and to provide the sustainability of our groundwater resources.
Thank you. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 19? Stand up, please. Yes, come on.
Good evening. My name is Debbie Deneen. I'm the conservation coordinator, and I'm speaking in favor of this bylaw on the behalf of the Conservation Commission. Okay, as Lisa explained, we have to adopt a bylaw. We are mandated by EPA and DEP to do that. But I'm here to tell you that we want to adopt a bylaw. Right now, the Conservation Commission has stormwater standards, the Planning Board has stormwater standards, and the town has an EPA permit, none of which say the exact same thing. What this is doing is this is consolidating these three bylaws into one that's a very workable bylaw that addresses what we need to have addressed. We need this because, as you can, whoops. Which way is back? That helps. I can't work my remote control on my TV either. As you can see, we do have problems, even though we have these three stormwater regulatory plans for the town. We need to consolidate them. We need to take a real look at what we have. Right now, the town is responsible for the drainage system. When the runoff is in your yard, you're responsible. The minute it gets into the town's drainage system, the town is responsible. What enters the system also becomes the town's issue. Okay. Stormwater runoff is not a nice thing. It contains all kinds of things that we just don't want to get into our drinking water. Prevention of all of these elements getting into our drinking water saves the town and the developer money. We'll have less to do in terms of filtering out and making our water quality better. We can work to improve existing systems and designing new stormwater systems to land disturbance standards which will maintain or improve our stormwater quality and quantity. This is where Sudbury is in our watershed. For those of you who aren't aware, we're in the Suasco or the Sudbury-Assabet-Concord watershed.
Everything in this watershed drains down to the Sudbury, Assavet, or Concord River, flows north into the Merrimack, and then out to the ocean. A watershed is an area of land that's drained by a river and its tributaries into a particular body of water. Think about your neighborhood river, creek, or stream. Where does it start? What types of landscapes does it pass through? What does it pick up when it's doing that, and where does it end up? All of the area covered is our overall watershed, shown on this map. This is a great map that was just produced by the town's Ponds and Waterways Committee. It shows the seven individual watersheds within town. If you have a chance, go online, look at this map, see which watershed you're in. It's very interesting to find out. Maybe you have something running through your yard that really contributes to stormwater runoff. Maybe there's something you can do about it. So where does all this stormwater go? Our stormwater runoff does not go to a treatment plant. Instead, the water and the pollution in it flow directly to our wetlands, streams, and rivers. That gets back absorbed to the ground and becomes groundwater. Groundwater is very much a hidden resource because, except in a few rare cases like Old Faithful or the Mammoth Caves, you don't generally see groundwater. Yet in Sudbury, groundwater makes up 100% of our drinking water supply. We need to collect and recharge rainfall to maintain water quantity, but we also need to be sure that the rainfall collected is stripped of the pollutants it picks up between the time it hits the ground and the time it reaches our faucets. So what does this bylaw that's being proposed do specifically for Sudbury? The bottom line is it helps protect the quality and quantity of our drinking water, and it protects property from new flooding caused by changes in land use. We have lots of changes in land use in town, and right now we have no bylaw that permits the town to intervene in any situation such as you see here until an impact occurs to a wetland area, which means that the polluted runoff has already entered this town's drainage system and is discharged to a wetland area. So what will the bylaw do? It can address local concerns and help us meet our EPA and DEP requirements. It will implement thresholds, design standards, and maintenance requirements for runoff conveyance systems. The steeper the slope, the less area needs to be altered to cause detrimental impacts. Alteration can be designed to implement best management practices.
Debbie?
That's it.
Bylaw says 5 minutes. About how much longer do you have?
30 seconds.
30 seconds. Okay. Does that meet the approval of the hall? It does. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moderator. Okay. The steeper the slope, the less area needs to be altered. Alteration can be designed to implement best management practices. Best management practices are not some major technical engineering feat. They are very simple things that can be done, such as limited impact development. It's an alternative and cost-effective way to design and build projects that mimic natural systems to filter and recharge stormwater on site. Some of those systems can be rain gardens, like you see in the picture. Other things can be options to have porous pavement in your driveway. Very simple things that homeowners and businesses can do to help infiltrate runoff. The bottom line is what we want to do is slow it down, spread it out, and soak it in. In other words, help along Mother Nature. The Conservation Commission very much supports this performance bylaw. It's simply a bylaw that sets performance standards for designs, and the Conservation Commission urges your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 19? Yes, in the aisle here, ma'am.
Susan Crane, 34 Robert Best Road. I am speaking on behalf of the Sudbury Ponds and Waterways Committee, which voted unanimously to support this bylaw. We were formed a few years ago by the selectmen to advise the selectmen on water quality in Sudbury. And Debbie Dineen just showed you a slide of our watershed map, which shows the various watersheds in Sudbury and maps our ponds and streams. And take a look at it when you can. There are many, many. I'm sure you have them in your backyard. You'll also be seeing in the next couple of weeks signs that we'll have displayed around town promoting eco-friendly lawn practices. And all of what we are doing is very consistent with this bylaw. We are protecting the quality of the surface water and the groundwater. The eco-friendly lawn practices are based on the same principle, that whatever we put on our land or runs off our land eventually flows into surface water bodies or infiltrates groundwater. So for this reason, we very much support it and urge you to also. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard? Yes. Can you pass the mic right here in the middle? Actually, if you come around front here, Elaine, can you pass that mic? Right behind you. Thank you.
Adam Miller, 1 Knobscot Road. The presentations were very informative and answered most of my questions, but one question I have is relative to the planning board deferring to the conservation commissioner and other board within the town for judgment under this article, and I wanted to know whether, if that's the case, and it was an application under under the wetlands bylaw, if then 2 permit fees would be assessed at that point, or if it would just still, or if you're already applying under a wetlands bylaw, if it would be wrapped into that application fee.
Thank you, Lisa.
It's a good question, and we are addressing that in the regulations. The intent is that there not be duplication of fees or hearings and so forth, and that's the reason for allowing the planning board to delegate to other boards or agents.
Thank you. Lisa? Anybody else have any questions or comments? Yeah, right, way in the back. All the way in the back. All the way in the back, on your side, that way, all the way in the back.
There you go. Yes. Roger Nichols, 220 Old Lancaster.
I'm sorry, we can't hear you.
Roger Nichols, 220 Old Lancaster Road.
Thank you.
It says the planning board is in charge of enforcing. Can you give a little more explanation of that and how the current stormwater runoff management issues might be addressed? How does this help that?
Lisa? Was the question, does the planning board enforce this bylaw? Was that your question?
That's one of them. And the other one is how do you...
Why don't we take that one?
The planning board would be able to enforce it, yes.
And your other question, please?
How do we bring up issues of stormwater runoff? For example, every time it rains, there's a nice flood in the middle of my right in front of my house.
Do you want to know who would you call about that?
Well, is it still the planning board? Does any of that change?
If it's an activity that's regulated under this bylaw, then it would be the planning board that you would notify. If what you're talking about is a violation of the bylaw, that would be the case. There will still, under our protection, be properties that flood in Sudbury. I'm afraid that we cannot, help that. There are some properties that naturally flood, but if your neighbor does something, such as builds a mounded septic system, this will prevent them from discharging or building it in such a way that it runs off onto your property and creates a new problem.
Thank you.
Does that also apply for basement pump out?
Basement pump out?
Sump pumps in basements.
The only way in which it would impact that is in terms of direct discharges to the storm drain system, which actually does require a permit from the Department of Public Works.
Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, right here on the aisle.
Robert Coe, 14 Churchill Street. Mr. Moderator, I move to amend the motion by striking from Section 4.0A the second sentence.
Yes. And the second sentence reads, any powers granted to or duties imposed upon the planning board may be delegated in writing by the planning board to any town employee, board, or agent.
Yes, Mr. Moderator.
But does that amendment receive a second? Yes, it does. Mr. Coe?
Mr. Moderator, I would read that with slightly different emphasis than you did. Any powers granted to or duties imposed upon the planning board may be delegated in writing by the planning board to any town employee, board, or agent. I can't believe that it needs to be anywhere near that broad. Now, in answer to a couple of questions, the planning board has said, yes, we would be the ones to enforce it. Although it was carefully phrased, yes, we could enforce it. I think that this gives the planning board way too much leeway to lay the enforcement off on just about anybody. So I think that nothing is lost by striking that sentence. And if the planning board decides at some point later that they need to delegate some of the responsibility, they can come back to another town meeting with the wording to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Coe. Mr. Coe, before you go away, we need three copies of that motion to amend. One here to me, one to the town clerk, and one to the ViewGraph so the audience can see it. We'll discuss it while you're doing that. Lisa Eggleston.
Thank you. I would oppose this amendment. The reason for putting this in is, as we discussed earlier, to avoid duplication, to allow the planning board to delegate, for instance, when a project is already subject to Wetlands Protection Act jurisdiction. They are applying these same standards. If this motion is passed and that is struck from it, it would basically mean that each applicant would have to go through hearings in front of the Conservation Commission as well as the Planning Board. The other thing that we're trying to allow for is for the Planning Board to delegate to its agent the review of some of the general permit applications, which are more or less a formality. They don't require public hearings, and they should not require a full convening of the Planning Board and vote on it, if it basically is meeting the thresholds that we've established. The other thing I will say is that the more specific information on how this will be delegated and under what circumstances will be addressed in the regulations that we're currently drafting, and that we will be holding public hearings on that, or a public hearing on those regulations, and there's opportunity for public input at that time as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on the amendment, which is to remove that second sentence? Way back there, can we have a mic?
I have a mic.
Yes.
Mr. Coe has posed a question that I
I just need your name and address for the record.
Cutting, 381 Maynard Road.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Sorry. He posed a question that was in my mind, so I think my question goes to the amendment. And Ms. Eggleston has touched upon it. It's not entirely clear to me, because this bylaw rests, it appears, the standards, the definition of best management practices, rests almost entirely upon standards developed for the Wetlands Protection Act. How would you distinguish, you just mentioned regulations, you say you've started drafting them, what do they look like? Because it seems to me that you do have overlapping jurisdiction. There's some mention of the water quality certification regulations of 314.9. As you know, those come out of the Federal Clean Water Act, and they're normally done as part of a Wetlands Protection Act filing. So it seems to me that this is duplicative, and I'd just like a clearer explanation of how you distinguish whether the planning board's going to review, are both boards going to review, particularly where you have a subdivision where you've got upland and wetland. It seems to me you need to have a clear explanation for the hall as to how you're going to either separate or coordinate those two authorities.
Yes, Ms. Eggleston.
This is part of what we are fleshing out in the regulations. To some extent, they are duplicative where there is Wetlands Protection Act jurisdiction. Just a reminder that the goal of this bylaw is to close that gap where there is not Wetlands Protection Act jurisdiction to apply the same level of standards. So really, we're trying to as Debbie said, apply uniform standards as opposed to inconsistent ones between the various boards. Now, where the planning board is, if they're doing a subdivision review, if we are doing a subdivision review, we do have stormwater regulations. This would become our bylaw. We would apply these regulations. The Conservation Commission would adopt the same regulations, so we would all be working off of the same page. And a lot of the, in our regulations, it references the state stormwater management standards that were developed as part of the Wetlands Protection Act. They are now part of the Wetlands Protection Act. There is an entire technical handbook that goes with those that establishes design standards and the like for best management practices and policies in terms of how you calculate infiltration and recharge and that sort of thing. And that is what we would refer to so that everybody's playing off of the same set of standards and rules of the game, so to speak.
Thank you. Hang on a second. Mark, can you put that motion back on the board, the motion to amend? The motion to amend is to strike the second sentence of section 4.0A. So please address your comments to that. If you want to talk about the bylaw in general, there'll be time to do that after we deal with this amendment. Anybody else wish to be heard on the amendment? Seeing none. This is on the amendment?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Please.
Sorry. I just wanted to ask.
I need your name and address again,
Rebecca
please.
Rebecca Cutting, 381 Maynard Road. I just wanted to ask a follow-up. It's still not clear to me. I understand the Conservation Commission will adopt the same regulations that the Planning Board adopts. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that consequently the stormwater regulations will be uniform. But where you have a site with upland and wetlands, is there going to be delegation entirely to the Conservation Commission, or will you be splitting the jurisdiction? I mean, that was my original question, and I don't think it's been answered. And it does, I believe, go to delegation.
Thank you.
Yes, this bylaw would regulate the upland areas, and if that would be administered by the Planning Board. So it would, if that's your question, we would be applying the same standards to the upland areas as well as the wetlands.
So an applicant might actually have to get two permits then. If they had both upland and wetland on the site, they'd be going to you for the upland and to the Conservation Commission for those areas that are jurisdictional under the Wetlands Protection Act, which is just the wetlands plus the 100-foot buffer.
Yes, we cannot eliminate the need for a Wetlands Protection Act permit, because obviously that covers also a number of other issues besides the stormwater, and it is a state regulation. So this would be in concert with that, regardless of who is issuing it. But I think that the type of project that you're talking about that would be before the Planning Board anyway, we would certainly administer the permit as we do now. This is the case oftentimes with projects that we permit for subdivision and also have CONCOM jurisdiction. It's just that the CONCOM's jurisdiction is limited to the resource areas that are regulated.
That much I understand. Just there was an earlier question about would you have to get two permits, and you said no. Sounds to me like now you're saying yes.
Okay, maybe I stand corrected that there would be two permits issued, but for projects that the Planning Board is not hearing otherwise and that have a notice of intent filed, we would be able to delegate to the Conservation Commission and have them issue the stormwater bylaw permit in concert with the notice of intent permit.
Would you delegate to any other town board other than the Conservation Commission?
The intention is not to delegate to another town board besides the Conservation Commission. That's what's currently the thinking in terms of drafting of our regulations. That's primarily because of we're looking for the expertise in stormwater management. We are allowing, though, for delegation to an agent such as the planning the town planner, or in some cases the building inspector, where they're very minor, the general permit application, there are certain things that the building inspector would be able to just sign off on.
Thank you.
Could I ask, what is it that the building, it would seem to me it might be the town engineer, but the building inspector?
I think the question is to strike the whole sentence about delegation. Her question is, would you be delegating to the building inspector, and if so, why?
Well, I can probably answer it this way in terms of the current motion, and that is to say that any of these specifics will be further addressed in the regulations, and that the opportunity for input will be provided through that public hearing process.
Last comment is simply that I would urge that the amendment be passed and that you be specific about to whom you're delegating in the bylaw.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on the amendment? Yes. Mike, please.
Thank you. Debbie Dineen, Conservation Coordinator again. I just want to clarify on the jurisdictional issues. Right now, the Conservation Commission has jurisdiction within 100 feet of wetlands or 200 feet of a perennial stream under the Wetlands Protection Act. Under our local bylaw, if work on an upland area is outside of those setbacks, but yet there's going to be drainage that's going to tie into an existing system that's going to discharge into a wetland, in that case, under the bylaw, the commission has jurisdiction. So I can only think of one subdivision in town where the drainage does not ultimately tie into a wetland. So, yes, there might be a few cases of overlap, but there will be very, very few. I think the big thing here is what we're looking at this bylaw can best be used for are redevelopment issues, in which case the drainage down in the commercial district is all being tied in to the town's drainage system and discharging directly into wetlands. So there might be a few cases where there will be overlapping jurisdiction and two permits needed if there is an upland subdivision where there's maybe only a discharge in a 100-year storm event that may have to come to the Conservation Commission under the bylaw. But those will be very few and far between. I think that mostly what we're looking at, too, is this is not just for new development, but it is for redevelopment. Thank you. I hope that helps clarify.
Anybody wish to be heard on the amendment that you see in front of you on the view graph? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, which is to eliminate that second sentence in 4.0, please signify by raising your cards. Those opposed, it is defeated overwhelmingly. We are now on the main motion. Anybody wish to be heard in favor or opposed to this article? Can we have Article 19? Is this it? Okay. Yes, in the middle, please. Can you get a mic?
Yes, Mark Taylor, 5 Liberty Ledge. The Planning Board's report at the end of the article basically talks about streamlining the process, and I'm not quite sure how that's supposed to happen. On page 18, 5.0 applicability, it talks about anything including but not limited to building permit applications, site plan applications, subdivision applications, wetland permit applications, grading, septic, earth removal, any activity that will result in a change in rate, da-da-da-da, shall not commence until this permit is received. Now, that doesn't sound like a streamline. That sounds like one more permit. Could you explain, please?
What do we have here? Town planner, Jody Kablak.
Jody Kablak, I'm going to give Lisa a break since this is a difficult article, and we do appreciate the questions. Streamlining will occur when let me start over again. This is a new permit. This clearly puts projects that never required a permit before
to require a permit, and that's required under the federal NPDES Phase 2 permit in the town. We're not saying that projects that don't have stormwater impacts don't need a permit. They do. But if those permits are part of a larger development plan that is before another board, that board, through the delegation provision, can be the permit granting authority. That's where the permit streamlining may come in, and that's why it's important that the planning board has the ability to delegate that permit to more than just the Conservation Commission.
Mr. Moderator, one more question, please.
Yes, go ahead.
Does any part of this bylaw exceed standards or thresholds of DEP's stormwater management regulations?
The bylaw differs from DEP's stormwater management regulations in terms of the thresholds, yes, because the thresholds that are established in DEP's regulations are specific to the Wetlands Protection Act. So that's one way in which it differs. We have also broken out things like the smaller areas on slopes and so forth as requiring specific permitting. So the thresholds are not the same as the DEP standards. The thresholds for triggering the permit are not the same. The performance standards that we apply are what are consistent with the DEP standards.
Thank you.
Monica, I want to make one more comment.
Yes?
I'd like to bring to the hall's attention, there's one aspect about this that I'm not sure people are focusing on. It has to do with the Planning Board's decision. Their decision is final. Now, if you haven't read the rules and regulations, you need to, because the decision is final, okay? There's an appeal process, which actually isn't an appeal process. It's reviewable, but it's really not about the merits of the decision. It's really about the process by which they made their decision. This is an important article. It's actually massive. I'm not sure anyone in the hall realizes just how extensive and broad the powers we're giving to the Planning Board here. It's huge. You really need to be aware of that. Thank you, Mr. Moderator.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on this article? I see none. All those in favor of Article 19 signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it passes by well more than the required majority. This article passes. We'll move on to Article 20. And we'll have Jody Kablak, Planning Director, for a motion under Article 20.
Move in the words of the article, except that the word principal shall be changed to the word principal, different spelling, in Section 5523, and the word calendar shall be inserted before the word year in Section 5540.
Does that receive a second? It does. Ms. Kablak?
Thank you. Jody Kablak, Director of Planning and Community Development, speaking on behalf of the Planning Board this evening. The first thing I want to do is briefly mention the changes between the article and the warrant and the motion. The motion differs only in respect to two technical corrections. The word principal in Section 5523 is misspelled, and we want to clarify the time period in Section 5540 on page 21 of the warrant by adding the word calendar to that section. Sudbury currently has a bylaw entitled Single Accessory Dwelling Unit, Section 5500 of the zoning bylaw. The current bylaw was proposed by the Planning Board and the Inclusionary Zoning Study Committee and was adopted by town meeting in 1992. The premise at that time was to allow some flexibility beyond the standard single-family unit to allow for separate apartments. The current bylaw provisions are very restricted in terms of who can live in those units. Currently, they are limited to only family members, domestic help, and lower moderate income households. Allowing what seemed to some residents as two-family homes was controversial at that time because in 1992 there were no multifamily housing developments in Sudbury, no senior condos, and no 40B developments. After 17 years, we've seen how those units developed and what impacts they have on the town. To date, current permits have been issued only for family members, so it is essentially an in-law apartment bylaw. And the bylaw as adopted has served its purpose. So why tinker with it? We're approaching the bylaw from a different angle this time. As the town has grown in the past 17 years, so have the needs of the residents grown. In support of those needs, we continue to work on creating ranges of needed and desired housing styles. We are still a predominantly single-family community, but we have few choices for single parents, divorced parents, small households, or lower-income households. This bylaw will help fill that need for types of smaller units without new development. This bylaw uses the existing housing stock to create these units, which has far less impact on the town and the neighborhoods where they exist. This is an environmentally sound alternative to new development. The changes proposed are focused predominantly on two major aspects of the bylaw, removing the occupancy restrictions while decreasing the allowable size of the units. The new bylaw allows these units to be rented to anyone, not just family members, but it reduces the maximum size of the units from 1,200 square feet to 850 square feet. One other significant change to the bylaw allows the creation of an accessory unit in a detached structure, such as a garage or a barn. In exchange for these changes, the bylaw continues to contain the proper controls to eliminate issues that are related to neighborhood disturbance or may be perceived to be related to neighborhood disturbance. Still, only one accessory apartment is allowed per lot. The number of people who can live in a unit is limited to four. The units are deliberately small to discourage larger households. The maximum size, as I said, is 850 square feet. All building and Board of Health codes must be adhered to. One unit must be owner-occupied, and there remains the limit on the number of units that can be created, not to exceed 5% of the total houses in Sudbury, or approximately 280 units. Switch the slide, please. So what is an accessory apartment or an accessory dwelling unit? They are small living units which are integrated into a single-family dwelling. They have the outward appearance of a single-family dwelling, but internally they are separate. They have separate kitchens and bathrooms from the main house, and they have separate means of egress. The owner of the house must live in one of the units, and no more than four people can live in the accessory unit. Now, we've investigated this concept with our counterparts in the neighboring towns of Concord and Lincoln, similar towns with similar issues and similar housing styles. Those towns do have similar bylaws, and neither have the occupancy restrictions that Sudbury has. Lincoln has 3.8% of its housing units as accessory units, and Concord has 1.5. Small numbers, and as we think will happen in this town, we don't think we'll see an explosion of these units. Neither town reports problems with these units in terms of school crowding, neighborhood disturbances, or other impacts. Now, you might be concerned about what these units might do to school costs if they're occupied by families with children. That's always the question that we hear. Why not restrict them to seniors only? That's another question we've heard. The size of these units is strictly regulated, and they are small by all standards. They will not be conducive to large families, and we do expect few children to reside in the units. And in fact, if they are not occupied with children, these units will bring in additional tax revenue just by virtue of the extra rooms in the homes. We did do a small study of assessment records that indicated that 11 out of the 17 existing accessory units that exist right now in town are assessed $118,000 higher than comparable homes in those neighborhoods, and that results in approximately $1,800 more in property taxes each year for these homes. While the bylaw restricts the total number of accessory units to 5% of Sudbury's housing stock, we do not think that there will be a significant increase in the number of units created under these new provisions. We anticipate that the majority of people who will take advantage of it are those who really need to. Not everyone will rent out a portion of their home. Creating an accessory unit requires significant capital expenditure and results in less privacy. The owner occupancy requirement will also reduce tenancy problems because the landlord will live on the property. Most of these units will probably continue to be in-law apartments. We anticipate relatively few units created, but passing the bylaw will give residents the opportunity to do so. Next slide. In closing, these units will provide choices for homeowners who have too large a house or who may not want to live alone or may have difficulty making ends meet and can benefit from receiving rent. They'll also provide better housing choices for people seeking alternatives to homeownership, young people just starting out, divorced parents who want to stay in Sudbury, seniors who have downsized and need smaller units. We believe that the article fulfills the stated goal of the master plan and the housing plan to increase the range of housing opportunities in Sudbury. The Planning Board, the Board of Selectmen, the Council on Aging, and the Sudbury Housing Trust all support the article. Thank you.
Thank you. Finance Committee? Finance Committee has no position. That's what it says.
No position. That's correct.
Thank you. Selectman Larry O'Brien.
The Board of Selectmen unanimously support.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 20? Yes, right here. Microphone to the front, right to the front here. Patty, can you get the mic from the Boy Scout and pass it back?
Adam Miller, Knobscot Road. My question on this article is relative to, given that there's a, with an increase in these accessory dwelling units, if that, if I assume that it would increase the number, total number of units over which our affordable housing percentage targets are calculated. So I don't know if there's still some way under the new, under the amended bylaw to, for those, the created accessory by, dwelling units to be made into affordable housing units, or if that was too complex to manage given the owner occupancy laws and whatnot else.
Sorry, I was busy verifying the first part of that question. If there's a second part, just say it again. But the assessors do not consider these two-family dwellings, so we do not believe that they will increase our total housing stock for the purposes of our 10% affordable housing requirement.
And the second question is if there's, I know that this amendment removes a low-income, well, I guess if it doesn't count as an extra unit, it wouldn't count as a unit if it was made into some sort of low-income.
That's right.
Correct. Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on this? Way in the back, sir, can you stand up?
Thank you. Kevin Long, 7 South Meadow Drive. We're one of the 17 people with an accessory dwelling unit, and I have a question and a proposed amendment. The first question has to do with...
If you have an amendment, you have to make it before you speak. You said you had a question and then an amendment?
Yes.
You have to make the amendment first.
Okay.
And then you can ask a question.
The proposed amendment is that with respect to structures constituting or containing an accessory dwelling unit for which a special permit was obtained at any time prior to the effective date of this amendment, so an existing permit, any references in Article 9 zoning bylaw to 850 square feet will be replaced with references to 1,200 square feet. This modified language will apply to both renewal of an existing special permit with respect to such accessory dwelling unit as well as to any new special permit applied for with respect to such accessory dwelling unit. So in other words, people who already have a permit and the space is larger than 850 feet wouldn't be denied a renewal of the permit or have to tear down their building because it's now 850 feet.
Does that amendment receive a second? It does. I have a question for you. Do you have to renew your accessory permit every few years?
Every 4 years, right.
Thank you. Thank you. I was just checking with town council to see if there's any way in your situation you would be grandfathered. And his answer was that you're not. So we will entertain this amendment. Now, I need it in writing with three copies, one to the view graph so the folks in the audience can see it, one to me and one to the town clerk. So while that'd be great. Now, did you want to make a presentation since your amendment has been seconded? And you can include in your presentation at the end a question.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Essentially, as I stated, there are people who already have a permit. And in ours, for example, my mother-in-law lives there. It's working out great. Wasn't forced to say that. But I've got some concerns with 4 years from now, or whenever the 4 years is up, what happens. Ours is about a little over 1,000 square feet. It's less than 1,100, but more than 1,000 square feet. So my concern with the 850 square feet is, would I have to kick my mother-in-law out when the 4 years is up? And currently that's not something I would consider to be desirable. So I would like to have anyone, and there may be other people who have current permits and the space is larger than 850 feet, so this would allow them to continue to have their in-law in their existing ADU without having to kick them out. And somewhat related question, in section 5567 on discontinuation of accessory unit, it states that if an accessory dwelling unit is discontinued, the owner shall notify the zoning enforcement agent of removal of the facilities. And I'm not sure what the term facilities means. I know when I was a kid growing up, the facilities were was the toilet. I'm guessing that that's not what's intended, so I'm not sure what that means.
Okay, that's something not involved in your amendment, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, we'll get to that later. Let's deal with your amendment now. The planning, does anybody else wish to be heard on the amendment? Yes, Mark, can you put that? We're in the process of doing that. As soon as it's done typed, we'll put it on the view graph for everyone to see. But in the meantime, does anybody wish to be heard to discuss it? We're going to get to the planning board in a minute. Okay, hang on a minute. We can't get to your question quite yet, because the planning board is looking at the amendment, so they can give us their opinion on the amendment, whether they're in favor of it or opposed to it. The planning board has no opposition to your amendment. Anybody else wish to be heard on the amendment? We're going to have to vote. No, this can only be on his amendment. Hang on. And then we'll vote on the amendment, and if anyone has any comments on the general bylaw, we'll get to that. Sir, could you stand up and just wait for a mic?
Jeff Claw, 15 Iron Works Road. A question on the amendment. Is this to only amend to the existing special permits, or is this amending the entire proposal to go from 850 to 1250?
Yes. It's only the existing permits, not new permits, and
okay.
It's 1200.
Yeah, unfortunately, we haven't been able to see it yet. We will shortly, and hope that should answer your question.
Okay.
Hang on, please.
Thank you.
Yes.
Judith Deutsch, 41 Concord Road, Sudbury. Speaking in favor of the amendment, it seems to me that it's only fair to grandfather this in, not only for family, but if other people have it for the reasons included in the previous bylaw, that should be grandfathered in too.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am. You want? Wait, hang on for a moment. Down here, please.
Abby Miller, 1 Knobscot Road. I have a question related to, it says duration of special permit 5550. It says that when you sell your unit,
Hang on a second. Does this address the amendment?
Yes.
It does.
Yes. It says that when you sell your unit, the permit is terminated. My question is, does this grandfathering apply to the person who then buys the house? Can they then continue to rent out their 1,200 square foot in-law apartment with the grandfathering under the amendment?
Town council informs me that if this gentleman were to sell his house, this couple were to sell their house to someone who wanted an in-law apartment with 1,200 square feet, they could still have it. It would run with the land. I'm sorry, I misspoke. They would have to apply for a special permit, but they could apply for 1,200 square feet, the larger number. Before we have it. Today's date. Sir, do I have your permission to add today's date to your amendment?
Please, thank you.
Thank you. And does the person who seconded that motion approve of that? Thank you. They're getting that now. Everyone had a chance to read the amendment? That's all we're voting for right now. Okay. Excuse me? No, the amendment is adding a new section. Is that what your question was? What's that? Um, the major headings are by 10. So it's 5550, 5560, 5570, 5580. And then the subheadings are underneath that. So the fact that 5560 only goes to 5567, that's okay. Yes. Come up and say it. We're creating a whole new bylaw. Go ahead.
You're right. There's no 5570, so this works out just perfectly. It can go right in there. Planning board is not opposed to this.
Thank you. Okay, are we ready for a vote on the amendment? We're not voting on the bylaw. We're only voting on the amendment. All those in favor of the amendment, as it appears on the screen, signify by raising your card. All those opposed. The majority is required. There's well more than two-thirds. We're now talking about Article 20, the main motion as amended. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 20? Yes, right here in the middle. Stand up, please. Can we have a mic?
Yes, Art Houston, 578 Peckham Road. I'm opposed to the article as amended because I think that the amendment itself is just too specific for this gentleman's home. For example, if someone's got is grandfathered and their dwelling is 1,210 square feet, they won't be grandfathered. Or if it's 31% of the single family dwelling, they won't be grandfathered. And for that reason, I can't support it because I agree with the spirit of what he suggested. I just don't think that we should be writing an article that is specific. And I would urge that we actually table this and vote on it on May 11th and come up with a better motion.
Yeah, the planning, sir, if I can address your question, the planning board informs me that the current bylaw is 1,200. So unless someone got a variance, which is very unlikely, for 1,210, we have no such. So this is not specific to this gentleman. It's specific to anybody who it's to create a grandfathering issue. So he doesn't have to kick out his mother-in-law. Okay. And other people don't have to kick out their mother-in-law. It's not specific to this gentleman. Yes, over here. Please stand.
Thank you, moderator. My name is Rosanna Woodmansee. I live at 105 Powers Road. And I've lived in Sudbury for 15 years. And I have two daughters, one of which was a commencement speaker here at Lincoln Sudbury High School in 2004. She was the recipient of the Atkinson Scholarship. And I'm mentioning this because I'm very grateful to live in Sudbury, and I want to continue to live in Sudbury, if at all possible. As my children get older, and I have one at home left, she's 18, she's a senior here, as they move out of the house, I become an empty nester. I have a beautiful house, as I said, on Powers Road. It has a basement that is a walkout basement, and it has a bathroom down there, and I would love to be able to rent my house. So I am in favor of this article. It would really help me in this situation, help me to stay in the town. If I had been a little more prepared, I could have brought you a PowerPoint of my house and my daughter at graduation and all of those things, but I didn't have that. And I just wanted to say one other thing that I mentioned at the hearing is that I like Sudbury so much, I even bought a burial plot here in town and hope to never have to really leave the town. So I am in favor of this article. It would help me a great deal. And also as the children get older, child support decreases for me. I do work full time. I have a good job, but it is difficult to maintain all of the finances and still be able to live in the town.
Thank you very much. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 20? Yes. All the way in the back.
Sorry, Mr. Moderator. I'd just like to come back to that question.
Can I read your name and address again for the record?
Kevin Long, 7 South Meadow Drive. Just to come back to the question I raised about the removal of the facilities and what that means.
Okay.
Predominantly, it would be removal of the second kitchen or any other facility that distinguishes this from it being part of your single-family home. We actually don't see, we have never seen a discontinuation of a unit to date. The ones that are in existence have remained in existence, but if at some point you do want to remove the unit, in any way, shape, or form, what we're asking is for people to notify the building inspector so that we can take it off the inventory. That's really why that provision is in there, so that if we ever did get to 5%, the next unit could be built.
But just, I apologize for, I don't mean to belabor this, but God forbid, assume my mother-in-law passed away. Would I have to take out kitchen cabinets? And
I mean, no, the duration of the permit is for the length of the time that you own that home. This will now allow you to rent it to someone else.
But assuming that we choose not to rent it, but my mother-in-law is not.
No, you only, it's voluntary to discontinue. You don't have to discontinue your unit.
I wouldn't have to remove the entire kitchen.
No.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Yes, can we have a mic over here?
Danny Vellum, 28 Maple Avenue. I'm a little confused as to where the 850 square feet came from. It doesn't say anything in the planning board write-up. We're going from 1,200 square feet down to 850. It seems a little arbitrary. We've had to amend it to take care of this fellow. Maybe somebody could speak to that.
Michael Fee, chairman of the planning board. Great question. We spent a lot of time trying to figure out this number, and ultimately we arrived at 850, and it is somewhat arbitrary, I acknowledge. But what we're trying to do with this bylaw is really balance a couple of things. As we were increasing the universe of persons that could occupy these units, we wanted to be sensitive to folks that were raising criticisms about doing something so drastic that you would really change the character of the town by, i.e., making units that were available to large families and kids in the school and all of that. So what we tried to do was balance that. By opening it up to a greater different types of folks, we wanted to circumscribe the living area and thus, at the same time, limit the size by regulation of those families. The important thing, and this speaks to the amendment as well, is that there's a provision in the bylaw in 5522 that allows the zoning board to waive the area requirements if there's an existing structure whose shape or topography or whatever means that it would make more sense to allow a larger living area. So even though the number is 850, there's a certain amount of discretion vested in the zoning board to be able to vary that under certain circumstances. Hope that answers Thank your question. You. Anybody else wish to be heard? Yes, on the aisle here.
Robert Cove, 14 Churchill Street. The answer to the last question got me thinking. I guess I'm having a little trouble with the planning board's reasoning on this. They're saying that because this the accessory apartments are being opened up to a wider variety of people, then we'll deal with any objections to that by having the people that rent the accessory apartments live under more crowded conditions. Is that what they're saying? And if so, does it make any sense to anybody? Maybe they just shouldn't change the number from 1,200.
Thank you.
Chris Morley from the planning board. I was one of the big proponents of reducing the size to 850. The purpose of both the original bylaw and this bylaw is to create accessory units. There are actually large numbers of houses in Sudbury that are 1,200 square feet. There are an even larger number of houses that are 1,400 square feet. An entire house is that big. It's a very generous amount. We moved it down to 850 because it is an accessory apartment bylaw. We're not trying to create two-family houses.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard before we vote? Yes, a mic to the on the aisle there.
Hi, Larry Jobson, 165 Morse. I wonder, has anybody given any thought to how these regulations are going to be policed? Before I moved to Sudbury, I was in Southern California, and you can't believe how many people they can get into 850 square feet, both legally and illegally. I bought a house that had one of these accessory units before, and I noticed as I did a little remodeling that interior to the walls there were lamp cord for wiring, going to bootleg and bogus heating units for cooking, et cetera, et cetera. And so I saw basically a horror story for, especially for neighbors putting up with essentially an uncontrolled situation in terms of how many people ultimately got wedged into what was already an approved unit. So I wanted to know if people are really addressing the possible unintended consequences of a large monitoring problem.
The bylaw would be enforced the same way that any other aspect of the zoning bylaw is enforced, and that is the building inspector would go to the site and investigate the situation and determine whether or not there was a violation. Just as our all of our zoning bylaws are designed to help people live together in harmony, one would expect that if there's a disturbance as a result of the occupancy of the accessory unit, that would get in some way reported to the building inspector and dealt with accordingly. So I don't really see it as being a an enforcement issue.
Thank you. Anybody else before we vote? Seeing? Yes, sir.
You, Larry Jobson, 165 Morse. You don't see it that way, but I can point to many, many municipalities where that is a problem, and just having a few words doesn't make the problem go away. I guess people are a lot more civil here in Concord and Lexington, et cetera, than Southern California, but I just wondered.
Sudbury, too.
Sudbury also.
The one thing that differentiates this situation from what I think you're describing is the fact that this bylaw requires the owner to live on the property. So there is some relationship between the folks that are occupying the accessory unit and the owner of the property. We would think that that would have some deterrent effect.
Thank you. We're now ready for a vote. This is a two-thirds vote. All those in favor of Article 20 as amended signify by raising your cards. Thank you. All those opposed? It's not even close. It's well more than two-thirds. We're now going to move to Article 21. On Article 21 has actually been withdrawn. We're now on Article 22. Chris Morley, CPC Chairman, to make a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Move in the words of the article, with the amount of $25,000 appropriated from Community Preservation Act funds.
Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. Morley?
As noted, I'm Chris Morley, Planning Board member and Chairman of the Community Preservation Committee. The next several articles are CPC articles. We're going to begin, as we do every year, with a hopefully 5 minutes or less version of the state of the CPA and Sudbury talk. Then we'll move on to Article 22 and the ones that follow it. It is not news that revenue-side problems and expense-side problems are challenging all of us in our work lives, our personal lives, and our civic lives. On some issues, we saw the storm clouds gathering a long way off. Other issues seem to come almost weekly as bolts out of the blue. All are wreaking havoc, as we saw tonight, on everyone's budget, everywhere. The Community Preservation Committee, as your neighbors and fellow taxpayers, as members of other standing town committees, as overseers of the Community Preservation Fund, are keenly aware of the times in which we live. In response, we have not changed course. Rather, we have rededicated ourselves to the conservative approach that I and the chair before me have presented to town meeting for each of the past 6 years. At those past six town meetings, we here together have voted to preserve 387 acres of open space, have begun 16 historic preservation projects, have approved several different kinds of community housing initiatives, such as keeping home ownership affordable in perpetuity in some of the capes and ranches that would otherwise be likely teardowns. And we've enhanced the physical well-being, safety, and enjoyment for all residents through miles of new walkways, a track oval, and athletic fields. To date, one half of all of the costs of these projects has been funded by the state of Massachusetts. Over the last 7 years, three-quarters of the households in Sudbury have paid $6 a week or less to make these projects a reality and to put aside substantial savings that in the future will enable the town to accomplish much, much more. Collectively, we have come together as a community to support CPA for an amalgam of reasons and goals, in much the same way that the state turned what was a land bank movement, in which Sudbury was a leader, into the four categories of the CPA. For most, the main goal remains open space preservation. But ask people to check off exactly why, and you get very different answers. Natural beauty, the environment, town character. Pay once for the land and never, ever have to provide town services to the people who would otherwise have lived on it. Other. Similarly, more and more groups in town are extremely supportive of community housing as being just the right thing to do. In part, they point to the Sudbury that I grew up in, where my first grade teacher lived around the corner, and still does, my sixth grade teacher down the road, and the fire chief up the hill from her. Other supporters are just hoping for leverage against Chapter 40B, the state law that precludes town control over dense housing complexes which are actually intended for the well-off. Supporters of these two categories and of historic preservation and recreation may fully support all four spending categories, or maybe they just accept the state-mandated 10% minimum expenditure for the ones that they aren't really their favorites. My point is that whatever the reasons that have brought us here together, the CPA in Sudbury has gained overwhelming support in the past and is enormously popular statewide. So far, 140 other Massachusetts communities have adopted the CPA. That brings us back to the revenue side problems that I mentioned in the opening. The CPC knew all along and planned conservatively for it all along that more towns joining the CPA would mean an eventual reduction in the 100% state match. That hadn't exactly happened yet last year, but the recession did happen, reducing the state's dedicated CPA revenue and trust fund. The result for Sudbury is the same. Last year's match, paid in October, was 72%. This year's match should be around 30%. Still, that's over $400,000, an amount with which a great deal can be accomplished here in Sudbury. State CPA funding comes from transactions at the registries of deed, house purchases, yes, but also mortgage refinancings and other activities. The CPC, conservatively, is not counting on state match percentage to rise anytime soon. But in truth, there's no reason to think that it won't improve as the economy, we hope, does. To date, the CPA in Sudbury has received $7.2 million from the state of Massachusetts. Our CPA bank account, the Community Preservation Fund, has a balance of $6.5 million, money that the CPC and previous town meetings have put aside for future open space purchases and other projects. Given those two numbers, we could think of that entire nest egg as our free state money benefit, which is such a key plus of the CPA program. That brings us to expense side problems. The conservative approach that I said we inform you about every year is this. We roughly spend, over time, about 10% in the three areas of community housing, historic preservation, and recreation. The intent of this is to preserve revenue for future high expense projects, which we anticipate mostly to be the acquisition of open space rights. This 10% target is not hard and fast, but in the absence of an especially compelling project, this rough budgeting has and will be a factor in whether the CPC forwards a project for town meeting approval. Now you can see on the slide here, in recent years, housing and recreation have inched up over the 10%. After tonight, they will move back down towards 10%. And historic, which I'll mention again soon, has done a lot of projects for the lowest amount of money. Tonight, they're hopefully spending some more money, and they'll get closer to their 10%. Our principal expense-side problem this year really was no worse than having to say no to worthy projects. We had 17 applications, all CPA-eligible and all with merits that could be and were thoroughly argued. However, among other issues, I think we felt that Sudbury's CPA had taken on quite a lot in the last 2 years, that the state revenue picture was disturbingly uncertain, and maybe we perhaps join the rest of the nation in hunkering down a bit and getting back to basics. In fact, most of what we will present to you tonight, dollar-wise, is historic preservation spending out of reserve monies, which can only be spent on historic preservation work. It's the CPC's job to review the eligibility of proposed projects, but also to look at the bigger picture and to take the longer view, something that we approach very seriously. Then and only then do we pass along to town meeting those projects that we feel merit your consideration. And that is what we will now proceed to do. So speaking on Article 22 is Sam Webb from the Conservation Commission.
Mr. Webb has been kind enough to agree to keep his remark relatively short.
In the interest of time, I'm Sam Webb, Conservation Commission. I'll keep it very brief. I think we have an article here that everybody can support, and it's going to be tremendous benefit for the town of Sudbury and very little cost. First of all, we're talking about a key piece of land along the river here. You can see outlined with the blue arrow. And here again, you can see along the riverway. This is a piece of land that we've got a seller who is willing to work with us at a reduced cost. We've got funds through the state, and the town of Sudbury really will not be required to spend much money on this. Again, it's a 1.43-acre parcel that connects two existing pieces of land that run parallel to the riverbank there. So we want to continue this continuity and have uninterrupted protection for the wildlife and the riverway there. Here you can see all of the targeted areas. The green encompasses all the areas that are now conservation land and protected land. In relation to other protected lands, you can see how this is a keystone piece. And it is grandfathered in, could be developed into a rather large buildable lot. It's a half an acre, but it's upland, and it has enough dry land so that you could actually have a house that was proposed of this nature right along the water, rather than the continued woodland and the protection. So what we have here really is a collaboration of a very willing conservation seller. We have Nyanza NRD trustees. We have the Mass Executive Office of Energy and Environment, Secretary of Interior, NOAA, U.S., the United States Fish and Wildlife, Open Space, and, of course, the town of Sudbury. The beautiful thing here is the cost to the town of Sudbury, you'll see, is very minimal. At the most, it's going to be $25,000. Debbie Deneen has filed a couple of grants looking for funding, and the seller has agreed to take a reduction in the purchase or the sale price from $520 that it was recently appraised at for a waterfront lot there. And she's going to reduce $120 to make it affordable for the town, and the maximum we would have to allocate would be $25,000. And just to capture it all, you know, why do we have such a big fuss over a small parcel of land? Again, it's a keystone parcel for the continuity of unfragmented and undeveloped land along the river on open space and recreational areas, has wildlife and scenic designation. It's included in the 2007 Heritage Landscape Inventory. It's also included in the 2001 Master Plan to prevent more loss of community character. It's going to maintain aesthetics for recreational use of the river and preserve threatened natural resources. To give you an idea of how it looked just a couple of weeks ago, that's how it is now, pretty natural. And we urge your support. The Conservation Committee supports this 100%.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Rayle for the Finance Committee. Finance Committee recommends approval. John Dravinsky, Board of Selectmen.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Board of Selectmen unanimously
and the Board of Selectmen unanimously support it. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 22? Please raise your card. Yes, right here. Patty, could you? We lost our Boy Scouts because they have MCASs tomorrow morning. So I explained that to you because I'm going to ask for three volunteers to run the mics. Newly elected Mark Collins just volunteered. Can you come out here, please? Can you grab a mic, Mike? Thank you. Appreciate it. No. Just flip the switch.
Robert Coe, 14 Churchill Street. The article
the description under the article says that this is a fully permitted building lot. And my wife and I drove over there yesterday afternoon and took some pictures. And alas, I didn't have them ready because I didn't think we'd get this far tonight. But that picture that you were just shown with the snow there, for some reason yesterday, that seemed to be pretty much all water. And I look at this lot, and this, to me, maybe it's fully permitted, but I really have a hard time believing that the owner of this lot is actually going to build a house there right along the river's edge the way it is. I don't see how you'd put a system in there. And I just wonder whether the right attitude at this point isn't to just do nothing and see whether he actually builds it. I doubt that he will. If he does, there are some woods there. The house, any house of a size that you could plausibly put in there probably wouldn't do that much damage. And at a time when money is so tight and when the state reimbursement is so low, I just question the wisdom of an expenditure like this. I would be extremely surprised if a house ever gets built on that lot. The map in the warrant shows it as being a good distance from the river, but as you can see from the aerial view, the floodplain goes right almost up to the road. And yes, there is one part of the property that's a little higher, but it's not a lot higher. And the water is very close. And I just think that, you know, I think this is one of those cases where the owner of the property maybe is getting a break that he doesn't really need.
Thank you. Debbie Deneen from the Conservation Commission.
Yes, thank you very much. And yes, it's odd to find a buildable lot in that location. And yes, it is definitely a buildable lot. It is a permits in hand buildable lot. It has enough upland. There is a loophole in the Rivers Protection Act where if your lot existed prior to August of 1997, you were grandfathered in that you only had to look at alternatives to build within the lot, which meant make the footprint as small as possible. There was, and the Wetlands Protection Act does not say the commission may permit it. The Rivers Act says the Conservation Commission shall permit it. An abutter to this property appealed the Conservation Commission's permit that approved the building with, of course, you know, 7 pages of conditions, but nonetheless it could go through. They lost that appeal in DEP, that the appeal was overturned and the commission's permit did go forward. Unfortunately, it is a buildable lot. The records are in my office. It had a building permit ready to go. It had a septic permit issued by the Board of Health, and it had a superseding order of conditions from the Department of Environmental Protection.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 22? I see none. This is a two-thirds vote, according to town council, because it involves the purchase of land and a payment of money. That better be a point of order.
No, Mr. Moderator, but nobody else wishing to speak. Am I not entitled to speak twice?
Since I announced when I asked everyone, I didn't see your card. So
I was waving it.
Yes. What is it, Mr. Coe?
I just wonder why, if this is such a great lot and such a great opportunity to build on it, why did the owner agree to sell out this way? I think if it was me and I had this opportunity on a lot that probably cost me very little and was fully permitted, I think I'd go ahead and build on it. So why is it that this lot is available the way it is?
Yes, Debbie Deneen, we have an answer for Mr. Coe.
Yes, Mr. Coe, this was a very, very complicated deal where the gentleman who purchased this lot to build on it, the one that did the design, was ready to build. The person who appealed and lost the appeal then went directly to the buyer of the lot. She found another lot on Lincoln Lane at 17 Lincoln Lane that had a house on it. The house was a teardown. She bought the other lot, and she was able to make a swap with the person who was going to build the new house. So there were no, he would still get his house on the river, but yet there would be no new houses on Lincoln Lane. She then agreed to, resell the lot for protection at well below its appraised value. And that's why we're trying to put together as much as we can in terms of funding outside of the town of Sudbury. And we thank the owner of the lot now for selling it at a significantly reduced price.
Anybody else wish to be heard before we vote on Article 22? I see no hands. This is a two-thirds vote. All those in favor of Article 22 signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? I see one in opposition. It passes by well more than the required two-thirds. I wish to ask the hall. It is now 10:30, or after 10:30. Our bylaw says that if we wish to continue, we need a two-thirds vote of the hall. The choices are twofold. We come back tomorrow at 7:30 to finish the last seven articles, which are neither on the consent calendar or IP'd. Or if you want to vote by two-thirds, we will stay here and finish the town meeting now and then adjourn to May 11th. So I will, does anyone wish to make a motion one way or the other? Mr. O'Brien.
Warrant, except for those articles that have been continued to May 11th.
And does that receive a second? Okay, does anybody wish to be heard on that motion? Mr. Coe.
Mr. Moderator, if this motion is defeated, I would then move to adjourn to May 11th immediately. Then we wouldn't have to come back tomorrow night. We're going to have to come back on May 11th anyway. And then we could dispose of these other articles at the same time that we have to come back.
Hang on. We're just checking with LS on the availability in case we require two nights on May 11th to see whether May 12th this auditorium is available.
Who's checking?
Scott Carpenter.
Do you wish to go ahead and vote? Mr. Coe's statement is accurate. Do you want to wait to see if LS is available, or you want to vote as to whether or not we keep going tonight? Yes.
Mr. Carpenter has reported that the 12th is available should discussion on the debate end. Mr.
So more than one night. So we have, yes, Mr. Morley.
We're guesstimating half an hour, and then we'll be done, and then the budget can be done on May 11th.
Okay, thank you for that. Anybody else wish to be heard on the motion? Okay, we have a motion before the hall. It requires a two-thirds vote. The motion, which Mr. O'Brien will put in writing for us, is that
certainly, Mr. Moderator.
Three copies to continue the town meeting beyond 10:30 this evening. All those in favor of that motion signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it fails. Mr. Coe, you wish to make a motion?
Mr. Moderator, I move to adjourn this town meeting until May 11th at 7:30.
7:30 here in this auditorium?
Here in this auditorium.
Thank you. Does it receive a second? It does. All those in favor, please signify by raising your cards. Those opposed, it passes by well more than the majority required. Thank you. See you on May 11th. Thank you all very much.